They're running a strange program, y'all.
This is the best of the other side of midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
This is the other side of midnight. I'm Frank Moreno. So I had a meeting this week with our owner, John Katsimatidis, who has a very good ear and a very good head for what listeners like hearing, especially in overnight radio. And he said, Frank, what people want to hear about in the middle of the night? Mysteries. Mysteries, mysteries, mysteries. I said, well, what kind of mysteries? He says, that's for you to find out. And I got to thinking, what mysteries are really still left unsolved and still unresolved? And what do people still have so much interest in? Let's pick something that has seen enough time pass so that there's a lot of research about it and a lot of information about it, but something that is still new enough that a lot of the key players are all still alive. And it occurred to me that the case of the Long Island serial killer is one such mystery. So I began an exhaustive search for all sorts of material on the Long Island serial killer. Written material, podcast material, all sorts of things, anecdotal comments about it in social media. And one of the most thoughtful podcasts that I came across on this subject was from a podcast called The Unresolved Podcast, which focuses on a lot of cases like this. And I am thrilled that the host of The Unresolved Podcast, Michael Whalen, who happens to be a terrific researcher in his own right, has agreed to stay up late with me this morning or this evening and chat a little bit about the case of the Long Island serial killer. Michael Whalen, thanks so much for joining me on the radio.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's an honor.
Well, no, the honor is all mine. Now, you are in the state of Alaska, right? So it's still evening for you. Yes. It's not morning.
Yep, it's about 10 o'clock over here right now.
Lucky guy. Lucky guy. I keep these hours up. I may move to Alaska. All right. Michael, for the uninitiated, for people, because we do have a lot of listeners all over the country and, in fact, all over the world, and some people outside of the New York area may not have followed the case of the Long Island serial killer or the Gilgo Beach killings as closely as those of us in the New York area have followed it, this. So I'm hoping you can take us, and I know this is a complicated story, but I'm wondering if you can take us to the very beginning. When did we first learn of these Gilgo Beach killings? What happened, and when did we learn it?
Gotcha. So that is a bit of a loaded question, but I'll try my best. We first learned about the Gilgo Beach killings in December of 2010, and that is about a few months after a young sex worker went missing. Police were doing, you know, just scattershot searches throughout that region, and one day this police officer who had a canine unit, they went out there for training, and they ended up stumbling upon what turned out to be pretty much a mass grave. There were at least four women in that one grave, and they have become known as the main victims of the Long Island serial killer. Some people might be familiar with the book Lost Girls by Robert Kolker, which is a really great book, by the way. But they are the eponymous Lost Girls. They are Maureen Brainerd Barnes, Melissa Bartholomew, Megan Waterman, excuse me, Amber Lynn Costello. Excuse me, I got marbles in my mouth. Mm. But they are the four main victims. They were identified pretty early on. They were all young sex workers that had gone missing between July of 2007 and September of 2010. So that's a pretty wide range, but there were just these four bodies in one spot. And as police started, you know, kind of expanding from that one region, they found so many other bodies.
How many other bodies?
So there are other bodies that were found on the beach or in the same general area, and I believe the number is 16 at this point. And this is kind of a tricky subject when it comes to this story, but police aren't really certain if they're all part of the same serial killer, or if, you know, like two or more serial killers might have been dumping bodies in this one general area. So that's kind of where a lot of the arguments online come from about certain victims or not. But
it does seem like a coincidence that if two killers were to choose the same location to bury or dump bodies, doesn't it?
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think it's, you know, even though this is kind of a big area, the odds of one serial killer targeting the same demographic and then dumping their bodies in this one spot over the same time period just seems, you know, the odds of that have to be astronomical.
So the Long Island serial killer or killers responsible for about 16 deaths, what was the most recent victim of the Long Island serial killer or killers, as far as we know?
So I believe the most recent victim was Amber Lynn Costello. She had last been seen on September 2nd, 2010. And that was just about 2 months before, you know, this mass discovery was made. And it doesn't seem like any more victims have been deposited in that area, at least by this killer. But there's no telling whether or not he might have had other dumping grounds. Depending on which people you talk to, they might say that there are links to, you know, this specific serial killer from Atlantic City, for example. But there's been no definitive link of that yet.
All right. So now that if people are hearing about this case for the first time, they know there were a lot of killings where the bodies were buried or dumped at this beach. And here's, I guess, the question that a lot of people are going to be asking in hearing about this case for the first time, if it's their first time. Who's responsible? Do we know who's responsible for these killings? And if we don't know definitively, does law enforcement have a theory that they're working with?
Gotcha. That is the unanswered question in this case, unfortunately, is the identity of the killer. The person who killed the victims found along Gilgo Beach has not been identified. In fact, many of the victims have yet to be identified themselves. There's at least one male victim, a child victim, and at least two or three separate female victims that remain unidentified. And police have theories. They've been playing them pretty close to the chest for the past decade or so. But one of the main suspects is this fellow named John Bitrolf, and he's someone that I talked about briefly on my podcast when I did a bit of a deep dive on this story. He was a Suffolk County resident that lived in Manorville. And Manorville is kind of the city that has a definitive link to the Long Island serial killer. Some of the unidentified bodies, for example, they had their body parts were disposed of throughout the 1990s, and body parts turned up on Gilgo Beach years later and then in Manorville. So there's a definitive link between the Gilgo Beach bodies and Manorville, where John Bitrolf lived. He is probably like one of the most definitive suspects. A lot of other people suspect the Suffolk County police chief for a time, James Burke. He was kind of connected to a big corruption controversy. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, but
I am. But he's in prison now.
Yes, he's in prison now.
But, not for anything having to do with these Gilgo Beach murders.
No. Sorry.
All right. No.
Stated that pretty definitively. But he's one of the suspects that's bandied about a lot, just because of, you know, he had odd happenings on Gilgo Beach and in that area. And there's a lot to unpack there.
No, that's for sure. And I will note that my brother-in-law, Josh, lives in Manorville, and I hope he has a good criminal defense attorney on standby. So we have we have John Bitrolf. We have the former police chief himself, James Burke. Is there anybody else that's frequently talked about as a suspect in these killings that you feel comfortable mentioning?
Not really that I feel comfortable mentioning. Some people have speculated that the clients of these women, that after all, at the end of the day, they were sex workers, so they made a lot of off-the-books kind of shady connections. Some people suspect some of them. Some of these women had, you know, pimps or, you know, people working with them that had, you know, criminal past. And so some of them have been bandied about as well, but there aren't really any suspects that I feel comfortable naming.
Got it. We're talking with Michael Whalen. He's the host of the Unresolved podcast. They've done several episodes about the Long Island serial killer. If you have questions about the Long Island serial killer, we'll try and get to them. Our phone number is 1-800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Thus far, this is a case, in spite of the fact that we're talking 16 murders here, that remains unresolved. Michael, tell folks who Shannon Gilbert is and how Shannon Gilbert relates to all this.
Yes, Shannon Gilbert is not an official victim of the Long Island serial killer, but her disappearance was kind of the linchpin of the entire case. She was a sex worker that traveled out to Gilgo Beach on the night of, I believe, May 1st, 2010. And this is about 7 months before all the bodies were found. Sometime that morning, she was visiting with a client. She had kind of a security guard outside in a car waiting for her. And at one point in the middle of the morning, she ran out of the client's house screaming that, you know, they're trying to kill me, something dramatic. It's hard to determine what the actual statement was that she made. But she came flying out of the house, very dramatic, and there was a search for her. Seems like the people that were there at the scene did not search very hard for her. Eventually, police got involved. And then that's how we figure out months later, there were these random searches that were actually looking for her that made the initial discovery of the bodies.
And was Shannon Gilbert ever found?
Yes, her body was found about a year after the initial discovery in December of 2011. And when police conducted the autopsy of her remains, they discovered that, you know, there was really no smoking gun. They couldn't really determine how she had died. So they listed her cause of death as death by misadventure, which is just a very strange thing, but surprisingly a legal statement.
Wow.
So it was just a very bizarre death. I know Dr. Michael Bodden was brought in by the family and their attorney a year or two later, and he conducted a different autopsy, and he found damage to her hyoid bone, suggesting that she might have been strangled. But unfortunately, that seems to be kind of like the last word. There seems whether or not she's related to the other bodies remains a point of contention for many, including the police. And so they have not listed her as a victim.
Wow. So there could be more than 17 victims of this Long Island serial killer or killers.
Yes. Yeah. The sad truth is that just so much of that area, like, for example, there was a hurricane, I believe, like the year or two after these bodies were found. And there's no telling if other remains might have been swept out or, you know, if he has a different hunting ground nearby that no one has discovered yet.
Wow. Can you stick around a few more minutes, Michael? I'll have to take a quick break.
Oh, absolutely.
All right. We're going to take your calls next for Michael Whalen talking about the Long Island serial killer. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Before we do, though, I do want to tell you about the law firm of Angiulli & Gentile. Angiulli & Gentile are specialists when it comes to workplace injury and workers' compensation. If you've ever gotten hurt at work, and you want to know how you'll get paid, how your work-related medical bills will get paid, how you'll pay your own bills when you're out of work, that's a degree of stress that you just don't need. And you know who can help you deal with those questions? The law firm of Angiulli & Gentile. They have been helping people just like you out for over 35 years. They'll help take the fear out of the workers' compensation process. These are good folks. I know them personally. They'll meet with you. They'll listen to your concerns and explain how the whole process works to get you the medical treatment and the workers' compensation payments you're entitled to. The Staten Island lawyers at Angiulli & Gentile have handled thousands of hearings and will help you walk with confidence. They offer both in-person consultations or contactless video appointments. 888-234-COMP. That's 888-234-2667.
77 WABC. It's the Other Side of Midnight, Best Of. This is the Best of the Other Side of Midnight.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Moreno, talking about the case of the Long Island serial killer, who might be one killer or multiple killers. We'll take your calls with Michael Whalen. He's the host of the Unresolved podcast. You can call us at 1-800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Michael, educate me about your podcast in general. Tell folks what you focus on with your podcast.
Oh, thanks for asking. My podcast focuses mostly on unsolved true crime. It was kind of just a passion project of mine that I started, you know, out of the blue one day, and it kind of took off from there. But I've always been interested in learning about these mysteries and unsolved stories, and I've kind of used the podcast to try and raise awareness for cases that are very underreported, so they don't get a lot of media coverage. You know, that's pretty much it. I just try and focus on these stories and do the best I can to research them.
Let me say hello to Deborah in New Jersey. Deborah, what's your question for Michael Whalen?
Okay, if you do know, what about they all had in common, they all had cell phones. And the day they gone missing, did they go back and retrieve the outcalls and the calls that were coming in? Did they do that? Because that would have some information.
Yeah, so police have actually gone through kind of their digital footprints to try and figure out who they were speaking to last. And unfortunately, this was a time before cell phones were as common as they are today. This was in the mid-2000s. So the cell phones they had, police were able to track down some information, but, you know, there wasn't a lot of, you know, the tracking and the various stuff that goes into cell phone technology these days.
Well, let me ask...
Oh, go ahead.
No. I was just going to say, I think Deborah's question brings up something I'd been quite curious about, which was the role of law enforcement and both at a local level and a national level. Now, if the police chief was, in fact, the Long Island serial killer, it's not exactly a surprise as to why they wouldn't have caught the killer and why there might have been some problems with the investigation. But I'm wondering if you can speak to what kind of job law enforcement did, either on a local level or with respect to maybe the FBI getting involved in terms of investigating these killings.
Yeah, so that's actually another really good question. Sorry I didn't really get to the first question. But, yeah, law enforcement, the involvement of them in this case is a little frustrating because at first they were insistent that this was multiple serial killers, and the public wasn't really sure what they were basing that information off of. One of the things that makes James Burke, the former police chief, somewhat suspicious to many is that he seemed to be blocking a federal investigation of this. He was insisting that there were, you know, two or more serial killers operating in this area, but he didn't want the federal government to get involved and kind of oversee the investigation. So a lot of people suspect that's very suspicious behavior. If you would just want the case solved, you would think that you would want the FBI working on it. But, yeah, it seems like that kind of has followed this investigation. And I think at this point the FBI is involved, but there's been no progress, no real progress on it for the last few years, it seems.
Interesting. So as far as we know in terms of what law enforcement's doing now, it sounds like very little.
I would think that they're working really hard behind the scenes. Whenever you deal with these unsolved cases, there's only so much that the police can release to the public. So I'm always a half glass full type of person. I like to think that they're working really hard behind the scenes. But I know that if I was a family member of someone affected by this case, I know that I would be frustrated with the lack of urgency, at least the way that it seems to me.
Yeah, no, that is for sure. 800-848-9222 if you have questions for Michael Whalen. What do the people who believe that there were more than one killer posit as evidence for that? What's the kind of the case for one killer versus multiple killers? What are the supporting arguments for each case?
Yeah, so the supporting argument for it being one killer is, you know, kind of the simplest argument for me. Just these were a bunch of victims that fit the same demographic. They were generally all sex workers in their 20s. They were targeted, kind of isolated by the killer, killed and then dumped in this one area. The believers that think there were multiple serial killers cite the time discrepancies between the crimes, because it seems like there was a very definitive set time period where a set of victims were killed in like the mid-1990s to the early 2000s. And then there's another set of victims that were killed in the later 2000s. So that very well could be, you know, like a difference between them. Like maybe the first batch of victims were killed by one killer and the second were killed by a second. Some people also point to the state that the remains were found in. It's been reported that some of the bodies were found wrapped up in burlap, whereas others were, you know, not to get too gruesome, were kind of dismembered and separated in various areas. So these are all clues that could point to separate killers. I don't know how much I believe in that. I just find it the odds to be too astronomical for, you know, one serial killer to be doing the same thing in the same general time frame. That just seems a little bizarre to me.
Now, to me, the interesting thing is the interesting theory about James Burke, the police chief, being the killer, is that here was the chief law enforcement officer in Suffolk County, clearly very well connected politically, able to become the police chief to begin with. What do we know about James Burke and his background and his professional career? Would it really be out of character for somebody like James Burke to be a suspect in these sort of killings?
That's a really tough one for me to answer. I do think that there is a lot of in James Burke's backstory that it definitely makes kind of the hairs on the back of your neck stand up when you're reading about it. He did have a propensity to, you know, deal with sex workers and, you know, people like that. He also had, you know, a litany of charges in his past that would make you question how he ever became the police chief. Hmm. Seems like he had a pretty rough youth. And then when he was police chief, he violated someone's civil rights, basically tortured them and conspired to obstruct justice. And those were the charges that were eventually that he pleaded guilty to. But, you know, that kind of judgment just makes you question, like, if he was able to do that while having this very important position and knowing that everything he did would be, you know, examined under a microscope, like what else was he up to?
What else indeed? Well, it is fascinating. You've done some great work on this as well as a lot of other unsolved and unresolved cases. If people want to listen to Michael Whalen's podcast, you can go to unresolved.me. That's unresolved.me, or you can just search the Unresolved podcast wherever you get your podcast. Michael, by the way, not only thank you for coming on, but congratulations. I understand you have a new baby.
I do. Yes. Thank you. Yeah. My wife gave birth about a week and a half ago. So we are very happy, but sleep deprived new parents.
I can imagine. Well, I'm sure she's just thrilled that you're spending your evenings with me instead of the baby and her. Thank you very much, Mike. I hope we can talk again.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
Thank you. That's Michael Whalen. Check him out on the Unresolved podcast. If you want to comment on any portion of our discussion, you're welcome to give me a call, 1-800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. We're going to do a series of interviews exploring the Long Island serial killer and seeing if we can't get some answers as to what happened and who the identity of the killer and maybe why law enforcement hasn't made more progress in this. 800-848-WABC. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Straight ahead.
77 WABC. It's The Other Side of Midnight. Best of. This is the best of The Other Side of Midnight. The Other Side of Midnight presents The Midnight Files.
Midnight in the desert, shooting stars across the sky. This magical journey will take us on a ride, filled with the longing, searching for the truth. Will we make it to tomorrow? Will the sun shine on you? Midnight in the desert.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. This is a show where, among other things, we try to explore the unexplained, the unresolved, and kind of dive headfirst into the mysteries that are fascinating us. And we have one mystery that is right in our area. And some of you may have followed this when it was first reported a few years ago, when bodies started popping up along Gilgo Beach. I sort of paid passing attention to it. I said, oh, well, that's interesting. That's terrible. I hope they catch the guy. And I kind of went on living my life. But the other day at the Talkers Convention, I ran into an old friend of mine, someone that I have spent far too little time with over the course of the last decade. And it turns out he gave me an education on the issue of the Long Island serial killer and all the mysteries involved and all the things that we don't know. So I became hooked on this story. I spent almost the whole weekend combing through all of his many podcasts and radio shows on this subject, and he is probably the best expert that I've spoken to of any journalist or any commentator that's covered this story. Very, very pleased that he's agreed to stay up late with us this morning. Very pleased to welcome nationally syndicated radio talk show host, award-winning radio talk show host, just had a bunch of big wins at the Press Club of Long Island Awards in seven different categories. My old friend, Frank McKay. Frank, thanks for staying up early. Getting up early or staying up late with us.
Hey, thrilled to be here, Frank. Thanks for having me.
So yesterday we gave the audience a little bit of a primer on the Long Island serial killer, that there's about at least 16 bodies that were found in this particular area of Long Island that we still don't know definitively who's responsible for this. Do you, before we get into what theories you might have, I'm curious, what do you think of law enforcement's handling of this case from the beginning, whether it's local law enforcement or even federal law enforcement? Do you think they've handled this case adequately?
Well, first of all, I think we have, and maybe this sounds like the political answer, but I think we have a wonderful set of police officers, men and women on Long Island, whether it's Nassau and Suffolk. But as far as handling this case, they haven't been given an opportunity to handle this case because somebody stopped it from the top, almost from the get-go. So the cops have not done virtually anything on this case. We just spoke to a woman named Lorraine Ella, and she's the mother of Megan Waterman, one of the victims. She was a sex worker, and she was murdered by these folks. And I believe it's them, not one person. And we spoke to this woman, and she's got a trach. And she told us that in 10 years that Suffolk County PD have been in touch with her five times. And for the most part, they basically just said, we're just letting you know we're working hard on your case and on your daughter's case, and we're going to really work hard for you. And that's it. They've never interviewed her. They've never asked her for anything. The FBI has never contacted her. And a big reason why is because folks at the top, and that included, well, it's County Executive Steve Ballone, for sure. He's the Suffolk County Executive. And for folks who don't know what that is, that's basically the governor of Suffolk County. He was elected in 2011. And the first thing that he did was he put in a guy named Jim Burke, or James Burke. And the two of them, the first thing they did is they got the FBI out of the investigation and virtually did nothing afterwards. The only thing that I could find that they've done, and I've spoken to everybody I possibly could who lives on Oak Beach, which is the community over there, the only thing I could see that the Suffolk County Police did was they sent a missing persons bureau around, and what I can gather is they went to about 10 to 15 different houses showing pictures of some of the sex workers who are young women in their 20s that were deceased. And they were showing them to, in some cases, 78-year-old women and saying, have you seen these folks? Have you seen these women? Or, you know, there was an 80-year-old guy they showed pictures to. And obviously the answer was going to be no. And that's what they did. And they shut down an investigation. And nothing has happened in a decade. And I don't blame it on the police. I mean, it was stopped at the top. It was stopped by the politicians.
Wow. So and this was never a serious investigation, and that's not a reflection on the hardworking men and women of the police department. There was some directive to not treat this in a serious manner, which is pretty alarming. Let me go back to, and if people are just tuning in, we're talking with Frank McKay. He's a syndicated radio talk show host, award-winning radio talk show host, a longtime friend of mine, and a guy that has been following this story for years and done a lot of great research in it that we're all now benefiting from. Let me go back to what you said a minute ago about your theory that it is them rather than a he or a she. Why do you believe that the Long Island serial killer is killers, multiple people, rather than one person?
Well, the first four women, young women that they uncovered were strangled. They were choked by a very specific way. And again, I'm certainly not going to try to be amateur psychiatrist here, but everything that you look at from a standpoint of methodology, those four were treated differently. They were killed differently than some of the others. And what we keep saying is that there's 10 to 16 bodies that belong to, that we know of, by the way, that belong to this particular set of killers, and they're killed in different ways. I think most people consider this to be a group effort and not a single effort. But again, the first thing that happened, and Erin Moriarty, who I think you know from 48 Hours, she's an award-winning, Emmy award-winning, multi-Emmy award-winning journalist. She spoke to Jerry Hart, who was the former police chief that Ballone had put in, and she left to take over, if you could believe this, to take over the head of security at Hofstra College. I think, and I don't know her, I can't speak for her, but I imagine it's out of frustration. But what she told Erin Moriarty back in September of 2020 is she confirmed that Jimmy Burke had asked her at the time, and she was the lead agent for the FBI on Long Island, to get out of the investigation. And they eventually got frustrated, and they did. And Burke and Ballone basically closed it down. I think, and again, it's there's so much that has happened over there. But one thing that people should know as background is that this is our own little, like, Epstein Island. Gilgo and Oak Beach has become that. And they've had these, and Frank, I apologize for the use of this, but sex parties. I sound like an 80-year-old man saying sex parties. I guess I would sound like a 90-year-old guy if I'm saying orgies, but they're a well-understood, well-established fact that are based on these sex parties that have there. And they bring in folks, they bring in women from the outside, and they pay them, and they do all kinds of crazy things with them, and they've been doing it forever, as far as I can tell, and they've been doing it for 25 years. And there's one group of heavily connected political folks and law enforcement people. They participate in these group activities, and some of the women, some of the victims, are believed to have been at these particular parties. So that might explain why they don't want the FBI in there. And again, I'm not saying Burke and Ballone are part of the killers, but they certainly covered up for the killers. And by the way, I'm certainly not waiving the fact of any of them being suspects. But again, by no means am I saying they killed, but they clearly have covered up this situation and stopped an investigation of a serial killing, of a mass murder.
The one of the suspects that's frequently mentioned, and I had a fellow on yesterday who mentioned him as one of the suspects, is a fellow by the name of John Bitroff. He is convicted of murdering two sex workers. He has suspected in the murder of a third. Do you believe that there's a possibility that John Bitroff could have been the murderer, or at least one of the murderers?
Well, if it was Bitroff, who, by the way, is tied into, you know, to some of these folks loosely, at least allegedly tied in with the, some of these folks, the quick answer could be maybe. But the real answer would be if it was John Bitroff, he's not connected enough where they wouldn't just throw it on him and just nail it and stop all of the speculation on who it could be. And all of the other speculation is somebody close to somebody in power, whether it was the DA, whether it's even the current DA, whether it's the county executive or you know, some key law enforcement person. Bitroff is not that important where they wouldn't have just thrown the book at him and said, hey, this is Lisk. And by the way, there's another name that comes up, and he's a deceased gentleman who started the aquarium out here. And it's like a major aquarium, sort of like what they have in I guess, Mystic, Connecticut. And he was a pillar of community type. And they originally pointed at this guy named Jimmy Bissett. And Jimmy Bissett was a very interesting discussion because he committed suicide on the day of his Christmas party at the aquarium. And this is, a year into Ballone taking over. And they found him dead in a car in a place called Veterans Park in Matatuck. And, he left a suicide note. And it was rumored, heavily rumored, that this was the guy. This was Lisk. In fact, the earliest reports I got from mutual friends of mine and Ballone's were that it's all Jimmy Bissett. And what I basically said to them, I said, come on. I said, we're not stupid here. If it was Jimmy Bissett and Jimmy Bissett alone, Tom Spoda, who was the DA at the time, who now has been convicted, he's awaiting sentencing, he would have did a grand jury report posthumously on Bissett and said, Bissett's the guy, Bissett's the murderer, give me the hero award. I've solved this serial killing. And then, and Jimmy Burke would have been off the hook, and this one would have been off the hook, and some other people close to law enforcement, Ballone and Spoda, would have all been off the hook. And he didn't do that. So what I maintain is that maybe, and again, I'm not saying it is Jimmy Bissett, but if Jimmy Bissett is the killer, like the Ballone people wanted to originally say he was, it's not Jimmy Bissett alone. It's Jimmy Bissett plus somebody close to Spoda, plus somebody close to Ballone, plus somebody close to Jimmy Burke. So it's not Jimmy Bissett alone. So for a while, I just basically, questioned that. And I wondered why they didn't just do that. And I found out during our investigation, our personal investigation, what happened. And basically, Jimmy Bissett has relatives that care about his reputation and their reputation, and they're not going to let, and they certainly weren't going to let Spoda do that and Ballone do that and just pass it off on them. They were going to scream bloody murder. There's some attorneys in there, and they're going to maintain his innocence. So they couldn't have just done that. The interesting thing, Frank, and it just hit me yesterday, I've been talking about this since 2013. I've been talking about it on the radio since 2016. And basically, I've been, talking about a cover-up. Everybody has come up to me that is a mutual friend of Spoda's, Ballone's, Burke's, law enforcement, and not a single person has said, hey, Frank, there's no cover-up here. What are you talking about? What are you, crazy? Everybody else has said, hey, listen, what do you have, a morbid curiosity? Why don't you stop? Why don't you shut the hell up? Why do you talk about this? Why are you talking about it? But nobody, not a single person, has said to me, hey, what are you talking about? There's no cover-up. I mean, it's unbelievable. In this whole time, nobody has said to me, this is not a cover-up, and tried to give me some alternative view of it. They've all said, shut the hell up. What are you talking about? Stop this. Ballone's pissed. Ballone. Everybody kept saying, Ballone's so pissed at you. And the truth is that Ballone started hating my guts. And I've always endorsed him from a political standpoint. I've always supported him, even on the radio. We've had him on. We've had Love Fest on the radio. I've never had cross words with Steve Ballone. He started hating my guts when I started asking simple questions about Lisk, the Long Island serial killer. I don't know why he's so possessive over this situation, but I have not heard anybody say this is not a cover-up. They've just said, Frank, shut the hell up. stop talking about it. Stop doing shows on it. That's all I've ever heard, and that's very telling.
It certainly is. We're talking to Frank McKay, a syndicated radio talk show host who has been covering this Long Island serial killer case for literally years. Let me go back to James Burke, and I want to remind the audience again, if they haven't followed this case or if they're not familiar with how things go on Long Island, this is a police chief. He was the head of the Suffolk County Police Department, and he was as well-connected as you could be in Suffolk, and he ultimately went to prison for crimes having nothing to do with this. But I spoke with a gentleman yesterday, a podcaster, who indicated that James Burke himself, the police chief himself, might be a suspect in these killings. That's something I've heard for literally years now. Do you give that theory any credibility? Do you think that Burke could have been either the killer or one of the killers?
Well, I'll say this. I wouldn't rule him out, and you can't rule him out. I actually think Jimmy Burke is the ringleader of the cover-up. And I'll tell you, I know Jimmy Burke. I know all of these guys, and I don't say it with any pride, but Jimmy Burke is a brilliant, brilliant mind, and some would argue that he's a brilliant criminal mind. He is, prior to Steve Ballone making him police chief, he has about, and again, this is allegedly because I don't know what's in there, but there's an internal affairs file on Jimmy Burke, or there was. I'm sure they got rid of it as soon as he got in there, but there's a political file on him and a problem file on him, over 2,000 pages long. I started looking at some of it yesterday. I'll provide you with some of it. It's the most unbelievable situation you've ever seen. And I mean, things that I think were absolutely proven. And of course, Ballone ignored that when it came time to put a police chief in. And he put Jimmy, his dear friend, in there. And by the way, they did it without Spoda's approval. And to be fair, Spoda, told me, he said, and again, personal relationship with these guys, Spoda said to me, Frankie, it was a punch in the effing gut. It was a punch in the effing gut the way they did it. He said, I wouldn't have stood in the way of Jimmy Burke ever doing anything. But the way they did it was sneaky, and they did it without me, and they didn't want me to know about it. And they put Burke in there. So anybody that thinks Spoda push Burke for police chief are completely wrong. Spoda did not do that. Spoda loved Jimmy Burke as a son, got involved with him during this John Pius case where a kid was killed by somebody shoving rocks down his throat. A young teenage Jimmy Burke became a witness, a key witness for then Tom Spoda, who was working for the DA's office as this kid was suffocated. And Spoda basically took Burke under his wing from that point on and raised him almost like a son type of situation. So the thing is that it's so heavily connected. To answer your question, there is no way that you could rule out Jimmy Burke as a suspect. The other thing is that there is a man I had him on. I think you spoke to him briefly, a man named Guy Malone, who was married to Heather Malone, a long-term relationship with Jimmy Burke. And he maintains that Heather Malone and Jimmy Burke ran a prostitution ring. This is Jimmy Burke as a cop. And again, I saw paperwork yesterday. I'll share it with you. I dare anybody to deny that they were running a prostitution ring after seeing what I saw yesterday. And it's all official paperwork that went from private investigators that went to internal affairs. It's chilling what they've done. And yeah, I mean, Jimmy Burke was according to this, allegedly was running a prostitution ring along with Heather Malone.
While he was the police chief.
No, this is prior.
Prior to being police chief. Got
yeah,
it. Okay.
And, yeah, it was reported though to IA, to Internal Affairs, and they had all of the paperwork. Malone just ignored it and put him in.
Wow, that is remarkable. I've written out pages of questions for you while you've been speaking, because you raised so many interesting questions. And actually, we're going to probably have you back next week to explore some of these. We'll take a few calls at 800-848-9222 if there's time. But there's two questions I want to ask you before we get to callers. One is, so much of this investigation involves this police chief turned convicted felon Jim Burke, who is a suspect as the Long Island serial killer. What do we know about him? What's his background? Where did he come from? What's his parentage? What's his story?
Well, there's some, I guess, unsubstantiated stories about linking him to even Jimmy Burke, a.k.a. known as Jimmy Conway. And his mother allegedly had a relationship with Jimmy Conway, which basically was Jimmy Burke. And he's
the Robert De Niro character in Goodfellas, for people that don't know.
Yes. And again, I've heard this story. And right now, I mean, let's call it a rumor. It's very difficult to say, hey, this really happened. But I've heard it from enough people, and there's enough explanation of it where I'm at least repeating it to you. I certainly wouldn't say it if it was completely unsubstantiated, but there's rumors. And his name is Jimmy Burke. He was the same name as that gentleman. And, his mother's family name is not Burke from originally, but on his birth certificate, it's James Burke. Now, I don't know. Again, I certainly don't want to, say, hey, that this is fact or whatever, but it's certainly worth exploring. Secondly, I mentioned the Pius case. It was a notorious case where, again, these teenagers were bullying, as we say now, to the extreme. And this guy, John Pius, I think from Hopog High School, he was suffocated by rocks being shoved down his throat. And Burke was a kind of a ne'er-do-well kid. And he ended up being a key witness for Tom Spoda in that case. So he was groomed through Tom Spoda to be a police officer. He rose through the ranks. He's a character, to say the least. And again, I never had cross words with him before I started looking into this, but he rose through the ranks as a cop, and he became a sergeant and an investigator detective. And when Tom Spoda won in 2001 for DA, he rose through the ranks, became the rackets, the head of rackets for the DA's office, and eventually Ballone picked him as police chief.
So you mentioned now, and then we will try and get to some other people, and then you're going to have to come back next week, Frank. But you've mentioned a couple of times Steve Ballone. And for people listening around the country, he's the Suffolk County executive, very prominent politician in New York, now being talked about as a potential challenger to Governor Cuomo next year. Or if Governor Cuomo ends up being removed from office or doesn't end up running for office, he's been talked about as a candidate for governor, been talked about as a candidate for Congress. Now, at the very least, we know that he appointed this police chief turned criminal, Jimmy Burke. Do you think the questions about the Long Island serial killer should be questions that that come to him in any prospective political campaign next year?
Again,
I want to point out that you've supported him for office as the chair of the Independence Party multiple times for Suffolk County Executive, and he's gotten tens of thousands of votes, thanks to the party that you were the chairman of.
Yeah. I mean, listen, no question. The reason 5 weeks ago we started up again our LISC series, again, for people just joining us, Long Island Serial Killing is a short is LISC for long. And we started up when Ballone started floating his name for governor and or Congress against Andrew Garbarino, basically because we know he's going to have to speak to a larger press group on Long Island. He basically owns Newsday. I mean, they rave about him. They never question anything that he does. And, I saw this as an opportunity to get some answers. And not only myself, but people that follow this, the Gilgo killings were excited, because basically if Steve Ballone is going to run for governor, he's going to have to answer some whys. Why did you put Jimmy Burke in? Why did you and Jimmy Burke get rid of the FBI? Why did you stop an investigation from happening for 10 years? And why did you seemingly cover up this situation? And by the way, these are questions he's never been asked. If you can imagine, we have 1.3 million people out in Suffolk County. But because he is potentially a replacement to Andrew Cuomo, it's exciting that he's going to have to answer these questions finally, and maybe we'll get somewhere for the victims' families of these
absolutely.
Gangsters.
Absolutely. Oh. Let me squeeze in at least one call here. Deborah is in New Jersey. Deborah, what's your question for Frank McKay?
These girls work independently. They advertise for themselves, either on those sites by themselves. Is it possible that the person that would find these girls was using them for snuff films? Somebody had a fetish, and they, you know, they wanted these films. It just sounds like these girls, it was isolated. If they wanted any girl, they can get any girl anywhere, you know, in these places you're talking about. So it seems like they would cherry pick, and nobody would really be looking for them, like days after or weeks after. You understand? It was very specific that they picked this type of girl that didn't work in an establishment. Is that possible?
You know, Deborah, if I could answer this, I almost jumped out of my seat when Deborah said that. Honestly, that's where I'm heading, and mentally, is that they were victims of snuff films, and I'll tell you what, it's more likely than not in my mind that's what happened. Deborah, thank you for bringing that up, but I am meeting with some folks on Saturday who are absolutely convinced, and they've been investigating this a lot longer than I have and more thoroughly. And Saturday and Sunday, and I'm actually bringing my wife with me just because of the subject matter and the fact that it's there are women there, and I don't know them, so I'm kind of bringing my wife along as cover, and she has some interest in this, and we're going to be discussing that exactly. By the way, there's an officer out here, a former officer who was a liaison to the FBI, a guy named Rob Trotta. Frank, you might want to bring this guy on. He's a Suffolk County legislator, but he is a former liaison to the FBI for Suffolk County Police, and he's anti-Burke. There's no question that he's anti-Burke, but
understandably, I would think.
Right. Well, he maintains, and this is he said this on record on my show and others, that when he first met Burke, that Burke asked him if he knew where to get a snuff film. Now, I can't confirm that happened, but this is what Rob Trotta maintains happening. And I'll tell you, first off, that Jimmy Burke, I doubt very much he would need to ask somebody he just met where to get anything and kind of film like that. But it does tie into Deborah's question. And there is a real pattern here I think, evidence going towards the fact that this is exactly what happened with Gilgo, and that it was violent porn. I've heard that term several times in speaking to different people, and there were violent porn guys, and that might be why Ballone and Burke wanted to get the FBI out of there, because they're filming or they're producing these type of sick movies where they're murdering women and you know, for sexual reasons and this filmmaking aspect. And again, I'm not saying Burke did, and I'm not saying Ballone did, but they certainly covered up and got the FBI out of there. But Deborah, it's amazing. It's almost like you read my mind.
Frank, we're going to have to end it there. Next time, we're going to have you back for a longer segment. I appreciate you staying up later, getting up early. It was great to see you at Talkers, and I'm glad we're in touch again, and let's not let it go another decade before we get together again.
And listen, I'm proud to be mixed up to be called Frank Morano by Brian Kilmeade. Frank, thanks for having me on. Call me anytime.
Thank you. Frank McKay. You could go to his website, frankmckayradio.com, if you want to hear some of the subjects that he's done on this subject. That's M-A-C-K-A-Y radio.com. Your calls straight ahead.
77 WABC. It's the Other Side of Midnight. Best of.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
This is the Best of the Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. We are the show that explores the great mysteries of the universe. And one of the great mysteries that we've been exploring is right in our backyard, namely the case of the Long Island serial killer. We began exploring this last week, and to me, the more you learn about this case, the more questions there are. And I am just thrilled that this hour we are joined by Shannon McGarvey. She is the senior producer of LISK, the Long Island Serial Killer podcast, and she's as much of an expert in this case as anybody, kind enough to join us at this odd hour. Shannon, good morning. Thank you so much for joining me on the radio.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
So, Shannon, I went into this a little bit last week with a few different folks, and they gave us the basics of what exactly happened at Gilgo Beach and what the gist of this situation was. But if people didn't hear my previous conversations on this subject, can you sort of set up what exactly we know about these Long Island serial killings? What's the basic of basics?
So basically, starting in, and it's arguable, but starting in 1996, some people argue as early as 1982, although it's not officially linked, bodies or parts of bodies have been showing up on the South Shore of Long Island and in Manorville. Back in 2010, basically what kind of tipped everybody off to this was a woman named Shannon Gilbert went missing in a community called Oak Beach, which is very close to Gilgo Beach, where the body parts of four remaining women were found. And it was the search for Shannon Gilbert that led to the discovery of the Gilgo Four, which tipped authorities off to a serial killer.
All right.
Or killers.
Yeah, well, so that is one of the big questions as to this here, right? Is it there are some people that seem to think there were multiple killers. Others think it was only one. What evidence is there to suggest one theory or the other?
Well, that is basically one of the biggest mysteries of this case. And there's a lot of conspiracy theories surrounding the Long Island serial killer case. So some people argue that it's multiple killers because, you know, a serial killer's MO does not change. We've spoken to multiple criminologists, people who've studied serial killers, who say, hey, man, they do change and they adapt over time. So it very well could be one person. Some people, there's a conspiracy theory that says that it's a group of men, which is quite frankly terrifying. And it's basically a cabal of wealthy men killing for fun in Long Island. So do we have hard evidence that points to that? No, there's no smoking gun, but there's lots of circumstantial, really interesting things out there. I personally lean more to one serial killer, specifically for the Gilgo Four, and then question if some of the other more fringe victims, so to speak, are actually related to the Gilgo Four killings.
Remind us who the Gilgo Four are.
So the Gilgo Four consists of Megan Waterman, Amber Lynn Costello, Maureen Brainerd Barnes, and Melissa Bartholomew, and who were all found on Gilgo Beach.
All right, and those were the first four bodies that were found?
Yes, that was in the search for Shannon Gilbert in the Oak Beach area. Police found the Gilgo Four.
All right. And tell me about your decision to start this podcast. Why, of all the unexplored cases, of all the unsolved cases in American history and even in the New York area, why did you guys choose to focus on this? What makes this case so special and so unique as far as you're concerned?
So, well, as far as I'm concerned, you know, I'm interested. I mean, I'm so deep in this now. We've been working on this, and I say we. It's myself and host Chris Moss and executive producer John Beal. We've been working on this since 2016, and it started as a documentary project for TV because Mopac Audio, the company that produces Lisk, Long Island Serial Killer, is, you know, our parent company is a television production company. So this started in 2016, and as a documentary project, we did a lot of research, and it was actually because it was a passion project of the owner of our company, and, you know, he was like, hey, I've been reading about this case, I've been following it. We think there's some corruption involved. I want you guys to get to the bottom of it. And we were like, okay, boss, sure. and took off running with it. Little did I know that in 2021 I would still be working on it. That it would transform into a podcast. That I would be like a dog with a bone. In terms of victim justice. I mean, it's been a wild ride, and I, you know, Chris said it in season one, but I mean, you know, I would be surprised if any sort of lay journalist or, you know, lay PI knew more about this case than we did, or had been working on it as long as we have. I mean, there are lots of people in the web sleuth community that we lean on that, you know, that know a lot as well. So, I mean, we're just basically, you know, doing the work that they're doing, but on a much more public platform.
Sure. Talking with Shannon McGarvey about the Long Island Serial Killer, you could check out this podcast, season one, the first six episodes, each one exploring a different aspect of this case, each one brilliantly told with a lot of great information, some great interviews, and a great flair for drama. Hate to put it that way, but it's true. You could check out the website at liskpodcast.com. That's L-I-S-K podcast.com. Shannon, you alluded to the issue of corruption. It seems that the Suffolk County Police Department is knee-deep in corruption as it relates to this case, and it goes all the way to the highest levels. Now, James Burke was the Suffolk County Police Chief. He was subsequently arrested for crimes having nothing to do with this, but we've since learned that the police chief himself is actually one of the suspected people that might be the Long Island serial killer. What do we know about the Suffolk County Police Department's handling of this case in general? And what do we know about James Burke's conduct as it relates to this case specifically?
Oh, goodness. So, so, you know, I'm of the mind. Well, first of all, yes, James Burke is a suspect. He is considered a suspect. I'm of the mind that, you know, I'm not going to go around saying that someone is a Long Island serial killer unless I have concrete, hard evidence. And, you know, can someone be, you know, is he a sexual deviant? You know, all signs point to yes. Has he done, you know, some horribly corrupt things in his life? All signs point to yes. I mean, the man went to federal prison for corruption and, you know, for the beating of Christopher Loeb. The guy's no walk in the park, but is he the Long Island serial killer? I don't know. You know, I'd have to see concrete evidence to make me say that he was. But yeah, I mean, I think everyone can agree that Suffolk County did not, you know, handle the case in a manner that was acceptable. There's evidence that was lost, evidence that was tampered with, you know, phone records that were lost. I mean, I believe that this case was solvable and is solvable. And perhaps had it landed in a different county under a different jurisdiction, it probably would have been solved by now, which is sad. Is it corruption, or are they just old school? Are they using, you know, all the tools they have? I don't know. I mean, they won't speak to us.
If people have questions for Shannon, they can give us a call. 1-800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. Just going back to something you said earlier, Shannon, about the possibility of this being multiple killers. You referred to it as possibly a group of wealthy men that carried out these killings. Why is that the theory? Wealthy men rather than any other type of socioeconomic status?
Well, so there's, you know, there's been reports of, you know, sex parties, just to put it, you know, plainly, sex parties out in on the South Shore of Long Island with very rich and powerful men in attendance, James Burke included, and you know, reports that, you know, after hours, weird things start to happen. So, you know, some of the theories or some of the, you know, conspiracy theories have said that, you know, these snuff films are getting made. And if you don't know what snuff films are, it's, you know, basically murder porn and, you know, involving, you know, sex workers. I mean, I believe it was Christopher Loeb, an acquaintance of Christopher Loeb, that said that he saw, you know, one of the Gilgo Four on a snuff film. Do I believe that? I don't know. I mean, why didn't he say this earlier? Why didn't we hear about this earlier? You know, and I would assume that he told Suffolk County about this. The FBI was involved. Why, you know, no one's been arrested, no, you know, except for John Bitroff, who is another suspect, and he's in jail right now. So,
and remind us who Christopher Loeb is.
Christopher Loeb was a, and I am going to describe him carefully because I don't want to disparage anyone, but Christopher Loeb was a man who is a recovering addict and had the misfortune of breaking into, you know, James Burke's vehicle and stealing a duffel bag filled with sex toys and pornography. What type of pornography is in question? At the time, he said that it was sick. So some people have jumped to conclusions and said, you know, oh, it's snuff films. You know, some people have said it, you know, was maybe involving, you know, people under the age of 18. But anyway, he was apprehended, and basically the long and short of it is that James Burke held him, chained him to the floor, beat him, and threatened to give him a hot shot, which is a lethal dose of heroin. Mm. So, he went to jail for it. I mean, and Spoda, the DA at the time, basically tried to cover it all up, tried to make it go away. And I mean, he's been ousted since and is awaiting, awaiting conviction.
Awaiting sentencing.
Sentencing.
We're going to continue with this discussion in just a minute. If you have questions for Shannon McGarvey, give us a call, 1-800-848-WABC. When we return, we're going to explore what law enforcement has done, what they are doing, what they should be doing in order to track down the killer or killers. We'll also find out from Shannon if there's another season of the LISC podcast coming up and what's likely to be in it. This is The Other Side of Midnight. I will tell you, if your problem has less to do with tracking down serial killers and more to do with chronic neck pain, back pain, knee pain, plantar fasciitis, shoulder tendonitis, or any kind of chronic physical pain, then I must recommend the good folks over at Trinity Rehab. These are the people that will restore your freedom to live your life pain-free. Now, don't be fooled. It's not your father's physical therapy. This is cutting-edge, state-of-the-art stuff. They have the EPAP machine, which is an FDA-approved, non-surgical, acoustic pressure wave technology similar to what's used to break up kidney stones. It breaks up scar tissue. It enhances healing, and it gets rid of pain fast. Before you resort to drugs, before you resort to surgery, try Trinity Rehab, because in just 3 5-minute sessions on this EPAP machine, you could be virtually pain-free. There's no prescription needed to get started. They're all over the state of New Jersey: Clifton, Paramus, Wayne, Short Hills, Emerson, East Windsor, Shrewsbury, Woodbridge. Call Trinity Rehab at 800-518-0977. That's 1-800-518-0977. You can also go to trinity-rehab.com.
77 WABC. It's The Other Side of Midnight, best of. 77 WABC. It's The Other Side of Midnight, best of.
Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. We are continuing to explore the Long Island serial killer or killers, and doing it with Shannon McGarvey, a person who has studied this case and dived headfirst into it over the course of the last 5 years. And you could see the product of a lot of that great work if you go to LISC. If you go and listen to the LISC podcast, and you can go to see it at liskpodcast.com. That's L-I-S-K podcast.com. Shannon, I am really so impressed at the production value of the first 6 editions of this podcast for season 1. What do you guys have planned for season 2, if there is going to be a season 2?
So there will be a season 2, and it will be premiering on July 14th, the first 2 episodes, and then we'll roll out episodes weekly after that, like we did in season 1, and hopefully with some bonus episodes as well. You know, with season 1, we started rolling out, and there was COVID. So we couldn't really, all our bonus episodes were sort of made from our respective home offices and, you know, home recording studios. So hopefully the production quality for season 2 will be a little bit better. and we'll still be able to get all that great content in.
All right. So you alluded to the FBI being involved in this case. Do we know what, if anything, either federal or local law enforcement is doing right now in order to catch or determine who the real killer or killers is here? And do we know why the FBI wasn't involved a bit earlier?
So, great questions. So this is what we're constantly up against in terms of what, you know, what does Suffolk County know? What is the FBI doing? You know, what is happening in real time? Like I said earlier, they won't speak to us. We've tried and tried and tried. You know, this is an active investigation. So a lot, you know, I would assume that, you know, law enforcement, they're going to hold their cards close to the, you know, close to the vest, so to speak. So I don't really know what, you know, what leads they're pursuing, what they're doing at this moment. I do know, you know, that in, you know, January 2020, they gave an update on the Gilgo Beach murder investigation and released an image of a belt. So they did, you know, they are releasing some evidence. Why did they do it then? I don't know. You know, why not earlier? You know, some people might say that it's, you know, the influence of Geraldine Hart, who, you know, is the Suffolk County Police Commissioner. She just left, you know, and she's former FBI. Another part of your question was, why was, you know, the FBI not brought in earlier? Well, you know, I think that, and this goes back to the, you know, to James Burke and the, you know, issue of corruption, you know, and people say, ah, this is the smoking gun. He tried to keep them out, you know, because he was guilty. Well, there was a lot of corruption, you know, in Suffolk County, well-publicized corruption with SCPD at the time. And I think it is my belief that if the FBI got involved on, you know, with the Gilgo Four, then it would be, you know, a veritable Pandora's box. You know, they'd start sniffing around and, you know, God knows what they'd find. But, you know, I have a source in law enforcement, not with SCPD, you know, that has told me, you know, he works on homicides, and he was like, look, if the FBI, you know, is offering their help and their resources, I'm going to take it. You know, I'm not going to turn help away. We want to get these cases solved. So, you know, the argument of meddling doesn't necessarily work for me in terms of like, well, you know, we wanted to do it ourselves. No, man, like you get help where you can get it, you know. And oftentimes, you know, SCPD, you know, I mean, neighboring precincts work with each other to help each other out. SCPD has been notoriously insular. They don't like bringing people from the outside in. The question is why? I don't know. I would assume it's because of a long history of corruption.
800-848-9222 if you have a question for Shannon McGarvey. Let's go to Tom in Rockland County. Tom, what did you have to say?
Yeah, Frank, how are you? And Shannon, how are you? I actually work nights, and I was working with somebody who lived in that area. And when that was going on, we used to tease him. And he whispered to me one night, you know, after one of the killings, he goes, she was a dirty this and that, and from Times Square. And I thought that was kind of offensive. And I'm going to give you his name. I don't know if you want to put it on the air, the suspect. But,
you should probably write in to if you go to liskpodcast.com, there's a tips page. I wouldn't encourage anyone to give the name of any alleged suspect on the air, just in terms of liability and legal matters.
Well, Tom, can you give us a waiver from any liability by telling us at least me and the radio station a waiver from any liability if you give us the suspect?
Well, let me put it this way. Shannon will figure it out. I know they do. They teach surfing in that particular area.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay.
He's probably about 70 years old by now, because I know he's older than myself. And his first name is Peter. Okay, let's put that.
Interesting. All right. Well, very interesting.
You said his first name is Peter.
Yeah, and he has a Greek name. Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
And you said that he said some disparaging things about a sex worker from Times Square.
Yeah, he said that. Yeah. And I thought that was kind of strange.
Well, yeah, there were several. There were right off the top of my head, two victims. Jessica Taylor and Maureen Brainerd Barnes, who were last seen or heard from in Times Square.
Said she was nothing but a dirty this and that. Who would even come out with a comment like that?
I mean, you'd be surprised. Or maybe not. But, yeah, I mean, that's part of the narrative of the story, is that, you know, these women, you know, were forgotten, lost girls, so to speak. You know, this was the season one was, you know, based on the book by Robert Kolker, Lost Girls, about the Gilgo Four and Shannon Gilbert. You know, SCPD, law enforcement didn't really care about them because they were just dirty so-and-sos. Well, you know, they were sex workers.
Thank you for the call, Tom. See, we get some tips on here on this show. Hopefully we'll be able to solve this case by the time the hour is up. 800-848-9222. So just going back to the Shannon Gilbert situation, and those of you that are holding, we'll get to you in a minute. So, Shannon, you mentioned that they discovered these bodies as they were looking for Shannon Gilbert, but apparently there's still some uncertainty as to whether she's actually a victim of the Long Island serial killer. Why is there any doubt that Shannon Gilbert, who's the investigation of her disappearance led to the recovery of the so-called Gilgo Four, why is there any doubt that she was a victim of the same perpetrator or perpetrators?
So this is disputed, and I'm of the mind that she was not linked. She's not a victim. Other people disagree with me, but the reason why I believe that she was not is first of all, the way her body was found, the way she went missing, I mean, they're completely different. She was a sex worker, which is why people linked her to the Gilgo Four. She and her body was found near Gilgo Beach, which is also why people like to link her to the Gilgo Four. And she disappeared under mysterious circumstances. All of which, you know, is, you know, fits with the narrative. But if when you dig in and when you drill down on the details, they're very different. Do we know what happened to her that night? No, we do not. I have theories, but we don't know. Was she murdered or did she die from quote unquote natural causes? We don't know. Again, there are theories abound.
800-848-9222. Let's say hello to Nikki in Manhattan. Hello, Nikki.
Hi, Frank. How are you?
Great, great. Thank you.
I wanted to ask Shannon what she knew about Shannon Gilbert's driver, because I know she supposedly had a driver / security guard. Was that somebody she knew and somebody she booked, or was that somebody her client sent for her, and what was his story?
Good question.
So his name was Michael Pack, and he still is alive. He's still around. He is not incarcerated, and she worked with Michael Pack. So the clients did not hire him. He was her driver, and And she was basically, she was a free agent, Shannon was. She didn't have, you know, you hear about these sex workers who have pimps. She didn't have a pimp. She was her own boss. And, you know, the, she, you know, was, when we interviewed Michael Pack and her ex-boyfriend, Alex Diaz, they were quick to, you know, to say that, you know, she was among the first, I guess, sex workers to use Craigslist and the iPhone. I mean, she would take it on the road. So she hired, you know, she worked with Michael Pack. He got a cut and he would drive her places. You know, Shannon lived in New Jersey and Michael Pack lived in Queens. So they would often meet in the city and wait for calls to calls, quote unquote, calls to come in, more like dates off of Craigslist. She had, you know, clients out. There's some evidence to suggest that she had clients out in Long Island and had been out there before. The night that she disappeared, Michael Pack says that, you know, they had never been there before. They had never been out there. Shannon kept meticulous notes. Her notes said that she had clients out in Long Island. He was her only driver that I know of. So.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Nikki. 800-848-WABC. Are all of the victims of the Long Island serial killer, are all of them sex workers? Was there anybody that was a non-sex worker that was also killed?
Yes. So there are some of, you know, there's a Jane Doe and her daughter, a baby Doe. The Jane Doe's name is Peaches, and she's called Peaches because of a peach tattoo. And her daughter, who was approximately 1.5 to 4 years old, we don't know if they were, I mean, obviously the baby wasn't a sex worker, but we don't know if the mother was a sex worker. There's some question if, you know, if Peaches was a victim of domestic violence and not of a, you know, a victim of like sex worker violence.
All right. We're going to continue with your calls in just a minute. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Hearing all of these stories of horrible killings and serial killers who have yet to be brought to justice, it's almost enough to make you lose your appetite. Well, it's a reminder, if that's the case, of how important good digestive health is to your overall health. Now, if you've lost your appetite, not because you're hearing disturbing news on the radio, but because you're just overstuffed with the garbage diet that so many Americans eat, let me give you a free word of advice. Life Change Tea. Go to the website getthetea.com and you will discover this powerful herbal proprietary formula that gives you more energy without caffeine, that tastes great, that's all natural, 100% organic, no GMOs, and that will cleanse your digestive system and cleanse your stomach from the inside out. It's a daily detox, a mild cleanse that gets all the garbage out of your system. That's why their slogan is the tea that makes you go. You can learn more about it by going to the website getthetea.com. Comes in 3 great flavors, pomegranate, peppermint, and plain. I, when I make it, throw a little lemon juice in there and a little stevia as well. You make it hot, you boil it hot, you throw a little water in there, keep it in the refrigerator, and you have this nice, refreshing, cold jug of tea, which is not just delicious, but it's incredibly beneficial to maintaining your overall gut health. That's where a lot of your health issues begin, in the gut. This helps regulate all your gut bacteria. Go to the website, getthetea.com. That's getthetea.com. And use the promo code Frank. If you do so, if you go to getthetea.com and order using the promo code Frank, you'll get to enjoy free shipping. We will continue with Shannon McGarvey next. 800-848-9222. It's 1-800-848-WABC. Straight ahead.
77 WABC. It's the Other Side of Midnight. Best of. 77 WABC. It's the Other Side of Midnight. Best of.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Moreno, really enjoying chatting with Shannon McGarvey. She's a senior producer of LISK, the Long Island Serial Killer podcast. If you're interested in this subject, it's definitely a podcast worth listening to. Go to LISKpodcast.com. That's LISKpodcast.com. Shannon, as I mentioned, there's not only an enormous amount of information in these episodes, but the way that you guys use audio and incorporate interviews, as well as have Chris narrate the story of what's happening, it's just told in such a brilliant manner. And it's really, quite frankly, a method of audio storytelling that I'm incredibly envious of. It's very evident how much work goes into all of these episodes. I am curious, what were the questions that you ended up getting from listeners to the podcast? What were some of the more common questions that people reached out to you guys wanting answers to?
Oh gosh, a lot of, you know, is it one killer or is it two killers? Is Shannon Gilbert connected? A lot of questions about James Burke, especially after the Unraveled podcast came out and kind of went all in on James Burke as Long Island serial killer. A lot of people were like, you know, really wanting to know more about that, wanting us to go all in. A lot of questions about SCPD, you know, why haven't they caught the killer or killers? Some questions about Bitroff. You know, a lot of people think that Bitroff, John Bitroff, is in jail for the murder of two sex workers from the early 90s. But he is... was widely thought of as a suspect of the Long Island serial murders. So, but a lot of people don't think that he's connected. They think that he's railroaded because of, you know, foibles and the DNA process. So, just the questions are all over the place.
And just to be clear, Bitroff has never been charged with any of these Gilgo Beach killings.
No. No, not at all. Not at all. If memory serves, it was a former prosecutor that was the one who said that he suspected that Bitroff was connected to LISK. So there's no hard evidence there. And the only thing that Bitroff has, you know, been connected to were the murders of the two sex workers from the early 90s.
800-848-9222. Let's go to Terry in Rockland. Hello, Terry.
Hello. I'd like to ask Shannon why she thinks it took so long until they found Miss Gilbert.
Oh, well, that's a good question. You know, there was some, you know, SCPD stopped looking for Shannon because of, you know, the winter. You know, like it was like, it's too cold. You know, we're going to just call off this investigation until it's, you know, until the weather conditions are better. You know, if I were her family, I would be livid at that. You know, you don't stop searching for a missing woman just because, you know, it's winter.
Do you think that's an indication, Shannon, that the Suffolk County Police Department really didn't want to find what had happened to Shannon Gilbert? Or is that, do you think it's a function of intentional neglect, or is it a function of incompetence, for lack of a better description?
You know, I think it's a perfect storm. Incompetence, definitely. Also, you think about the fact that, you know, immediately after Shannon went missing, Chief of Detectives Dominic Barone was removed from SCPD by Jim Burke. So you have this person who's handling this investigation. It's completely taken off the case, and a veteran, veteran member of SCPD. So incompetent. I also think they just didn't care. You know, I mean, it's like, okay, so a sex worker is missing, big deal, boo-hoo. You know, it just wasn't on, you know, the list of priorities. And it didn't become a priority until the heat was on, until, you know, victim families, you know, started really, you know, hooting and hollering about this. And when they resumed that search, you know, is when they actually, it wasn't even, they didn't even resume the search. It was a training. It was like a training exercise with a former member of the SCPD, John Malia, and his dog Blue. They were out there, you know, in Gilgo Beach, and they found remains. So they weren't even really looking for her, not in a comprehensive way. So is it corruption? Yes, I think a little bit. You know, Jim Burke was at the helm, but I think it's also incompetence.
Very interesting. Let me say hello to Deborah in New Jersey. Deborah, you're on.
Hi,
with
how
Shannon.
Are you?
Hello.
Okay, I have two questions. First of all, does this guy Jim Burke have a storage bin somewhere? Have you ever researched that?
I don't know that he has a storage. All right. Do you mean like a storage unit?
Yes, a storage unit. Absolutely.
You know, we
like to give away their, you know, yeah. That's just a thought. Secondly, this girl, Gilbert, when she did call the police when she was running away from the house naked, and she was saying that they're trying to kill me. They're trying to kill me.
Yes.
From the house. Now, did somebody go to the house where the party was? And whose house is this?
So she wasn't naked. She was clothed, but it was the party was at a house at the house of a man named Joe Brewer. And party is a loose term because by some accounts he was alone. Some people say that there were other people there. There's no evidence of that. There is loose evidence that someone was staying with him at the time, but was not present that night. So why did Shannon say they're trying to kill me? We don't know. I mean, that's part of what makes that, you know, her story so interesting. Who is she talking about? Who is trying to kill her? Why does she think that they're trying to kill her? There, you know, theories abound. We get into this a little bit in, you know, in season one, but, you know, Shannon may or may not have been, you know, suffering from, you know, some drug-induced psychosis. And that's not, you know, to disparage her character. You know, Alex and Michael, her driver, say that, you know, the night before she had stayed up partying on another call. You know, there's some suggestion that she might have had untreated bipolar disorder and was not on medication. So, We don't really know what was happening. I don't know that Joe, you know, what Joe Brewer did. I just know what he said. And he said that she freaked out. That's what we know.
800-848-9222 if you have a question for Shannon McGarvey. Aside from Shannon Gilbert, Shannon, how many victims do we believe there are of the Long Island serial killer or Long Island serial killers?
So 10 victims have been officially linked to the case. It would be the Gilgo Four, which I said earlier consists of Maureen Brainerd Barnes, Melissa Bartholomew, Megan Waterman, and Amber Costello. Then there's also Jessica Taylor, Valerie Mack, who was actually just named last year. She was just identified by SCPD last year. Then there was an Asian male Doe, the Baby Doe, which was the daughter of Peaches, and Fire Island Jane Doe, which was the earliest known victim.
Shannon, in terms of the killings themselves, right? You have a section on the website, and again, I want to encourage people to check out the website at liskpodcast.com, highlighting new evidence. Is most of the new evidence stuff related to the belt that you alluded to, or is there more? And if so, what is the new evidence in this case?
So, yeah, basically, just like we said, it was, you know, it's the belt, the release of the image of the belt. and the identification of Valerie Mack. You know, personally, I feel very connected to the does of this case. And, you know, whereas I don't know if this case will ever be solved, it is my hope that we can at least, at minimum, give the does back their names. So it was a great victory, personal victory for me, to see Valerie Mack get her name. She was previously referred to as Jane Doe 6.
Charles in Kew Garden Hills, what's your question for Shannon?
Well, actually, I have a comment to make. There's one thing that I've been listening carefully, and there's one thing that I have no doubt about, that we will never, ever know the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. There's too many people in corruption, and when people are saying in the conversation about the FBI, well, 3 years ago or 7 years ago, I might have said, oh, the FBI are in this, they're honest people. They're going to, no, they're corrupt too, right? We learned that recently, didn't we? So, and there's too many people that are so corrupt that will never come even close to the whole being stalled. Mind-boggling. We'll never know. I'm sorry, Shannon, but you'll never come to the whole conclusion.
Well, thank you, Charles. Are you optimistic, Shannon, that there will ultimately be a definitive answer to this, or do you share Charles's pessimism about this?
Well, you know, I am hopeful. I mean, why else would I do this if I didn't have some hope or optimism? You know, I think about the victims. I think about their family. You know, I put myself in the family's shoes. I have a daughter, and I would never give up hope, ever. You know, God forbid if something like this had happened to her. So I want this very much so to be solved. And I think that the only way we can do that is to keep talking about it and, you know, to keep shining a light on all of the injustice and, you know, corruption surrounding this. So that's my heart talking. My head says probably not. You know, like I'm not. You know, it's been over 10 years since, you know, the discovery of the Gilgo 4, and we've made very, very little movement since then, and even longer since the discovery of the first linked victim in 1996. Which was Fire Island Jane Doe. So, I mean, these killings have been happening for a really long time, and no one has caught the killer, as far as we know. You know, now, again, like we said earlier, there's some, you know, theories that say he died, committed suicide, he's in jail, you know, whatever. We don't know. And it's, you know, Chris Moss, the host of the show, and I have often sat around and said, God, don't you just want to know? Like, who is it? Like, I just want to know. And unfortunately, I don't know that we ever will. I pray that we will, but I don't know that we ever will.
I do wonder if, you know, whether or not James Burke is a serial killer. It's clear that he was a pretty shady fellow and kind of the last person that should have been heading a police department the size of Suffolk County's, which is, you know, a pretty large geographical area, pretty large population center. And I do wonder if now that the person who appointed James Burke to that position, Steve Ballone, is talking about either running for governor or Congress, if he's going to face increased questions about his appointment of James Burke, and if that might potentially lead to more information about the police department's handling of this case.
He better. I mean, anybody who, in my research, anyone who is attached to James Burke at all has that stink on them. And it is just, I mean, I don't think it's any surprise that, you know, politicians are, you know, have some level of corruption, right? That's an old, you know, it's the old song and dance, right? But on this level, in terms of, you know, Suffolk County, it just seems to be pervasive. And, you know, one of the highest paid, police departments in the country, and just corruption is rampant. So I hope that, you know, anybody who is affiliated with James Burke, an SCPD at that time, would be thoroughly investigated and put on blast, because I can guarantee there were some kickbacks or something going on. There was some, you know, level of corruption happening. Whether they were participating in it or knew of it and were complicit, you know, I can guarantee you it was happening.
Well, Shannon, the hour has just flown by. I appreciate you being so generous with your time. Thank you for doing such a great job on this podcast. I want to encourage anybody that's interested in this case, check out your podcast, LISK, L-I-S-K, LISKpodcast.com. Shannon, hopefully we can chat again in the future.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you, Shannon McGarvey, the senior producer of LISK, the Long Island Serial Killer Podcast. Next hour, no guests. It's just you and me. You want to comment on anything we've covered today, now's your opportunity. 1-800-848-WABC, 1-800-848-9222. Until next hour, keep asking questions.
WABC. It's the Other Side of Midnight, best of.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
This is the best of the Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano. 77 WABC.
Everybody, this is the Other Side of Midnight. Let's start the week off right, shall we? Well, I am somebody that loves a good mystery. In my view, that's really what overnight radio is all about, is exploring the unknown, the world of mysteries. And the only thing I like better than exploring mysteries and exposing them and telling you about maybe something that you thought you knew about but you actually didn't, and raising some questions about it, the only thing I enjoy doing more than that is actually providing answers to those questions. Well, I am just thrilled. We are joined for the entire hour by a gentleman who has made an art out of answering questions to deeply held secrets and long-kept mysteries. We are joined by best-selling author, distinguished investigative journalist, and the author of a brand new book, which I'm going to tell you about in a second, the one and only Mark Shaw. Mark, thank you so much for staying up late with us this morning or this evening.
Hey, Frank, thanks for the nice words about me. I appreciate it very much.
Well, thanks for all the great work you've done, not only in this book, but in your previous works as well. Before we get into your newest book, which is called Collateral Damage, The Mysterious Deaths of Marilyn Monroe, JFK, and Dorothy Kilgallen, before we get into this, I think it's important to remind people about your work with respect to the investigation of Dorothy Kilgallen. Now, some of our listeners who are a little older may remember Dorothy Kilgallen from her work on the printed page. They may also remember her from being a New York radio personality on another great New York radio station, WOR, or her work on television at the time. But for people that may be a little younger, remind folks who Dorothy Kilgallen was and your initial research in your book, The Reporter Who Knew Too Much, about why her death may have been the result of something suspicious rather than what we were told at the time.
Well, thanks, Frank. You know, I didn't know anything about Dorothy Kilgallen when I began this. Actually, this new book will be the fifth time that I've touched on things with the assassination, but I really didn't know anything about her. Until I got into looking at the assassination, I actually practiced law with a famous lawyer in San Francisco, Melvin Belli, who represented Jack Ruby at trial. And when I was investigating his life and times and getting ready to publish a book called Court of the King of the Courtroom, there was a clue given to me about Dorothy that propelled me into looking into this woman. And I'm like everybody else. When I was growing up, I remember what's my line, an intellectual a quiz show that was on CBS every Sunday night for, I think, 20 years or something like that, live. And for those that don't remember, and by the way, there's hundreds of episodes up now on the Internet, but basically they guessed, it was a panel show, and they guessed people's unusual occupations. There was one that a woman sold dynamite and things like that. But Dorothy spread out her gifts. She was a college dropout. She rose to the top of the celebrity list with What's My Line, but she was also an investigative reporter. She had a gossip column called Voice of Broadway. She was syndicated to 200 newspapers across the country.
Wow.
And I quickly learned then even more that she had covered the Lindbergh baby kidnapping case, the Dr. Sam Shepard murder case that became the movie The Fugitive, and, of course, I think is the most credible reporter to have ever covered the JFK assassination, because she was actually at the Jack Ruby trial. She was the only one to have investigated him. And then if that wasn't enough, she raised three children while she had a radio show, as you say, on WOR. So the New York Post at the time kind of summed up this incredible woman by saying she was the most powerful female voice in America. And I think that was an accurate statement at the time.
So what were we told about her death at the time in the 60s, and why is that inaccurate?
Right. Well, when I began to look into what was going on with Dorothy, after she was at the Ruby trial, she ended up deciding whatever Ruby told her. She went to New Orleans. She investigated a mafia don that she believed was responsible for the JFK assassination, to basically for revenge of what Bobby Kennedy had done as attorney general, deporting him. And so she was on the ball with regard to that, Frank. And then she went back to New York and she said, you know, if the wrong people knew what I know about the JFK assassination, it would cost me my life. I'm afraid for my life and my family. I'm getting a gun. And about a week later, she was found dead over there on East 68th Street in a townhouse she had in a bedroom she never slept in. She had on her eyelashes, her hairpiece, and her makeup, that never wore that to bed. When the police came, they found her, you know, found her dead. Her hairdresser first found her, but she was found dead. And they found an empty Secanol bottle on the night table. And just, I think, said to themselves, well, here's another celebrity that overdosed. And so they went ahead, and that was the verdict by the medical examiner. Now, in the new book, Collateral Damage, I include an interview that I had about 6 months ago with Dr. Michael Bodden, who I was surprised to learn had his name on the autopsy.
Wow.
And so I got him to finally admit that they had no idea really what had happened. Remember, the verdict actually was an overdose of barbiturates, circumstances undetermined. But as we'll learn in Marilyn's death, basically the media just took off with whatever verdict they wanted to, and so they said she died of an overdose. There was absolutely no investigation at the time, and so I've been fighting over the last few years to try to get that done. Cyrus Vance was going to do it. He didn't do much. But I can tell you something you may not know, and that is that about, 4 weeks ago, I guess, I got a voicemail from a detective named Philip Panzarella with the New York a Cold Case Squad, telling me that he was going to look into Dorothy's death. So we corresponded some, and I talked to him a couple times, and then I sent him all of the evidence that I had in both the reporter who knew too much and the follow-up but denial of justice. And as far as I know now, they are going to investigate Dorothy's death. So I'm pleased that that's happened.
Well, that's encouraging, and it's a testament to your work in the two books, which are still worth reading, The Reporter Who Knew Too Much and Denial of Justice. I'm curious, aside from that reaction from law enforcement, what has the reaction been like to your first two books with respect to what you've published about the Kilgallen murder and the fact that she might have been killed because of her work trying to expose the truth about the Kennedy assassination? What, if anything, have you heard from other law enforcement entities, from anybody that was associated with Dorothy or her family, and maybe even anybody associated with the Kennedy family?
Yeah, in that situation, you know, and it's we're going to look at similarities with Marilyn's death, because in Collateral Damage, I found almost 50 similarities, and I'll tell you how that happened. But
yeah.
The first thing I did, you know, I'm a former criminal defense lawyer and a legal analyst for the networks on some big trials and things like that. I always looked at motive. And when I found out that, looking at some forensics, that there wasn't just one barbiturate in Dorothy's stomach, there were three. They had done some tests later by saving some of her bodily fluids, and that they found some residue of phenobarbital on a lid of a glass there that made no sense for somebody who would, you know, have overdosed that particular way. So I think that I was able to pretty much prove in the Reporter Who Knew Too Much, which became a bestseller, that she was murdered. So I started looking at why that happened, and it really came down to the fact that she had to be silenced by those people who had orchestrated the JFK assassination. A real break came when I found a detective, I think it was the Sussex County Police Department or the Sheriff's Office, I believe, as I remember. He got in touch with me, and he was really in tune with the theories that I had. He actually knew one of the forensic guys who did the later tests on Dorothy, and so he was able to substantiate the fact that it looked to him like murder as well. And then we looked at a suspect, main suspect, who's still alive today, Ron Pataki, lives in Columbus, Ohio. He was a confidant of Dorothy's and really knew about her JFK assassination evidence. And we believe from the evidence that we found that he leaked that information to what we would call the wrong people. Mm. And in the new book, Collateral Damage, I actually found a source who told me that Pataki himself, he was a journalist in the Midwest, had gotten in trouble. And the wrong people, again, and we can go into who that is, but the wrong people came to him and said, look, we can get you out of the trouble you're in, but you got to tell us what Kilgallen is going to put in that book she's writing for Random House.
Wow.
And as this source said to me, you know, Mark, when he told them what she was going to write, that she was going to implicate Marcello for the orchestration of JFK's death and J. Edgar Hoover for covering up, she was dead.
And based on your further research, does the Kilgallen theory that Marcello was responsible for the Kennedy assassination and that J. Edgar Hoover was largely responsible for covering up the JFK assassination, does that seem to hold true based on your research?
Yeah, I think most people who've read those books and experts and things like that have come back to me believing that that happened. You know, I looked at the JFK assassination, frankly, different than anybody ever had. This was based on a good conversation I had with Ruby prosecutor Bill Alexander. When I asked him about JFK's death, he said, well, I didn't think he'd be killed. I thought it'd be Bobby Kennedy because he had many more enemies than JFK. And so I came up with a theory that what you need to do is to look at why Bobby Kennedy was not killed in 1963 instead of why JFK was. And when you do that, you see the motive for killing JFK so Bobby would be powerless, because if you kill Robert Kennedy, JFK would come after you with everything the Justice Department had. But if you kill JFK, Bobby would be powerless, and
right.
That's exactly what happened. They never bothered those guys again.
We're talking with Mark Shaw. He's a veteran investigative journalist, an attorney, best-selling author. His latest book, which came out on June 1st, the 95th birthday, what would have been the 95th birthday of Marilyn Monroe, is Collateral Damage, The Mysterious Deaths of Marilyn Monroe and Dorothy Kilgallen and the Ties That Bind Them to Robert Kennedy and the JFK assassination. We will take some of your calls throughout the course of the hour. If you have calls for Mark about his work, his research, his methodology here, or his findings, you can give us a call 1-800-848-9222, 1-800-848-WABC. All right. Before we get into the who and the how of Marilyn Monroe's killing, we've heard a great deal over the years about Marilyn Monroe having an illicit romantic relationship with both John F. Kennedy and Robert Kennedy. Additionally, we've heard that she had a romantic relationship with Chicago mobster Momo Giancana. Now, this is the kind of thing that's repeated so often, I think many people just assume it's fact. Based on your research, before we get into her death, is that a fact? Did she indeed have a romantic relationship with all three of those individuals?
Well, let me just stop one of those theories right away. That the Giancana thing is not Marilyn. That's just not her. She was never involved with him. Let me explain a little bit about why this book was written, because I was not going to write it, Frank. And hopefully now I have resolved three true crime murder mysteries in the book, but I wasn't going to write it because I was done after Denial of Justice. I'd done what I could for Dorothy and everything else, and so I wasn't going to, but I had all these listeners, programs like yours and supporters and people emailing me from around the world. Is there a connection between Marilyn and Dorothy and their deaths and their life and times and everything else like that? And so I began to look into that, and I found that there were connections. I have in the book, columns by Dorothy about Marilyn. Marilyn had been to Dorothy's home or over on East 68th Street for parties. They knew each other. And so I started to look, and, I always had in the back of my mind, it just didn't, jive with me that she would have committed suicide, because it just didn't seem like to me that that's something Marilyn would have done. So I started to look into that, and to answer your question, and then I'll tell you how I came around to it, there's no question that she had an affair with John F. Kennedy. Most people remember that, Frank. She sang Happy Birthday
Sure.
to him over there in Madison Square Garden, but that love affair was very short-lived. And so when I started looking into that, after I decided that there was something, or basically Dorothy in a column had decided there was something suspicious about Marilyn's death, I turned my attention to Bobby Kennedy. And I can kind of give you the journey as to how I ended up with Bobby Kennedy being the main, suspect in her death. I just want to read you one thing that Dorothy wrote just the day before Marilyn passed away. Marilyn's health must be improving. She's been attending Hollywood parties, has become the talk of the town. She's cooking in the sex appeal department. She's proved vastly alluring to a handsome gentleman who is a bigger name than Joe DiMaggio. That was her former husband in his heyday. So don't write off Marilyn is finished. I found a quote from her masseur that she had at the time. She was looking the best she had in years, and her publicist, she's in good spirits. And so just like you, a curious guy, as you are, always looking for the truth, I started to really wonder what was going on with Marilyn, and that's when I really started to look into her life and times and her death.
All right, we're going to pause here. We will continue with your calls, and we'll find out who was responsible, based on Mark Shaw's research, for Marilyn Monroe's death and how that death ties in to the killings of John F. Kennedy, Dorothy Kilgallen, and maybe even Robert Kennedy. 800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. This is The Other Side of Midnight. We'll continue with Mark Shaw straight ahead.
77 WABC. It's The Other Side of Midnight. Best of. 77 WABC. It's The Other Side of Midnight. Best of.
Second, please.
Please, Mr. Kennedy.
Oh.
I want to go. Don't show me
in the outer
space. Oh. Please, Mr. Kennedy.
Uh-oh.
I want to go. Don't show
me in the outer
space. I sweat when they stuff me in the pressure suits. Rubble, hell, that.
Please, Mr. Kennedy. A terrific song from Inside Llewyn Davis. And if you listen to these guys singing about going into space, it really makes you appreciate what a decade the 1960s was. It was a decade where people started looking towards the future. It was a decade in which it became clearer and clearer that the United States was the world's only superpower. But as we've seen with the deaths of John F. Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and others, it was also an incredibly violent period in our history where we saw race riots, where we saw all sorts of things. And a gentleman who has really caused a great deal of controversy with his work investigating the death of Dorothy Kilgallen is Mark Shaw. He's an attorney, veteran investigative journalist, and a best-selling author. And in his new book, Collateral Damage, he makes a pretty compelling case that the death of Marilyn Monroe is pretty directly tied to the deaths of John F. Kennedy and Dorothy Kilgallen. All right, Mark, bottom line, Marilyn Monroe, if she didn't commit suicide, if she didn't get hopped up on drugs and kill herself that way, what exactly happened based on what you've learned?
All right. Let's remember this. Those three people you mentioned died within 40 months of each other. Many people don't realize that. Marilyn died in 62, JFK in 63, Dorothy in 65. I didn't realize that. Well, they did. And so once I had the suspicions about, you know, Marilyn's death, I mean, with what Dorothy Kilgallen had written and that she wasn't in bad humor or anything or depressed and all that, the first thing I did is what I think you would do. You looked at the autopsy. And the first autopsy that they had said she died of an acute barbiturate poisoning ingestion of an overdose. I have it right in front of me. Well, then I looked. Excuse me, I dropped my papers.
Sure.
Then I looked at 5 hours later, and the verdict was probable suicide. Not suicide, but probable suicide. Now, I interviewed Dr. Cyril Weck, who's probably the foremost forensic scientist.
Sure, he's been a guest on this show several times.
Sure. Yeah. And he told me this. I've done or looked at 16,000 autopsies. I never saw one that said probable suicide. So that really got me going. And then I looked at, you know, trying to see what Dorothy Kilgallen wrote about it. And after that verdict, Frank, she basically wrote a column called, you know, that was basically with people who had mailed her questions and everything. Why was Marilyn's door locked that night? Why was the light on? She never slept with a light on. Why was she found in the nude? You know, all kinds of questions about the death and made me wonder about the questions in terms of what happened. And so I just began going through what I could learn about what was happening to Marilyn at that particular time. And it wasn't JFK who was the new man in her life or anything. It was RFK. So I started looking at that situation as to what kind of a relationship there was. The first thing I came across was a letter that just socked me in the jaw from Jean Kennedy Smith, JFK's sister. Understand that you and this is a Marilyn. Understand that you and Bobby are the new item. We all think you should come back with him when he comes east. Thanks. Jean Kennedy Smith. Then there was a CIA document that I found that was just after Marilyn died. Robert Kennedy has been having a romance and a love affair, sex affair over a period of time with Marilyn Monroe. Robert Kennedy was deeply involved emotionally with Marilyn Monroe, and he repeatedly promised to divorce his wife to marry Marilyn. So these kind are the kind of things that were going on in her mind. And then there was that smoking gun that all investigative reporters look at and try to find. And I found a CIA document that was issued on the day before Marilyn died, and it's just amazing. It talks about a wiretapping of a Marilyn Monroe Dorothy Kilgallen call. First of all, it talks about, I just heard you talking about UFOs. It talks about JFK, Marilyn, and Dorothy's obsession with UFOs. And then it goes into the fact that there was an event that Marilyn went to just before she died, and there was apparently some mix-up in terms of what was going to happen at this party, that Marilyn felt like she was going to be passed around by Sinatra, the two Kennedys, all that kind of thing. She was furious. She left there, and the document that I'm talking about says, subject Marilyn threatened to hold a press conference and would tell all. And then it says the subject made reference to bases in Cuba and knew of the president's plan to kill Castro.
Hmm.
Well, it doesn't take much logic to realize that if she threatened to go to the media about the love affairs with JFK and RFK, that would be one thing. But they had apparently, for whatever reason, pillow talk or whatever, or trying to impress her, had shared matters of national security. And so I said to myself, well, Bobby Kennedy's not going to let that happen. And so I began to keep going forward, and I found these documents. The book is all about documents. I found a couple, a couple of FBI files that talked about the relationship, him promising Marilyn he would marry her. And then basically what happened is that just like JFK had dumped her, Bobby dumped her. She was going to go to the media, and as we get close to August 1962, they cannot let that happen. The biggest problem I faced is that Bobby had an alibi being up in San Francisco. And yeah, he wouldn't have had to have been in, you know, right there when Marilyn died. But I wondered if I could, you know, do something with that. And I found actually a ledger over at 20th Century Fox that talked about the fact that he was in the city at that time, that, you know, he landed in a helicopter with Peter Lawford. and he was there on the actual the day that Marilyn died. I found a Beverly Hills Police Department officer who stopped a car with not only Peter Lawford driving and Bobby in the back seat, but Marilyn's psychiatrist in the front seat, too. So he obviously was there. And so I tried to look at exactly then how Marilyn died, getting around to your question. And that is that initially they thought she had ingested 40 to 50 pills within the time she took them and the time she died. Well, there was a police detective on the scene, the first guy there, who said that was impossible. There were some questions about what kinds of substances were in her stomach. I found from the autopsy that there was a bruise on her left hip. I questioned what the housekeeper was doing in the middle of the night when they found Marilyn's body in her bedroom. She was doing the wash. And all of these questions lead me to giving the reader in Collateral Damage a plausible account of how I think Marilyn died, based on the fact that I proved that on that day that she died, Peter Lawford and Bobby Kennedy went to her home and begged her not to go to the media about the love affairs and about the national security secret she had. And as it, almost in just exactly like what happened with Dorothy, when I had a source there that was very close to what happened, he said when she threatened to go to the media with all of that information, she was dead.
So we think Robert Kennedy killed directly or indirectly. Obviously, it sounds like indirectly. Robert F. Kennedy killed Marilyn Monroe.
That's exactly right. And he wouldn't have done it himself. So operatives, and I give a plausible scenario as to how those operatives went to the home and all of that. I can just give you, Dorothy Kilgallen was a great investigative reporter because she looked at the little things that made sense. And there's a number of them I could give you, but I'll just give you one. There's an FBI memo that talks about a book that had come out in 1964. And it was written by a guy named Frank Capel, The Strange Death of Marilyn Monroe. And that book is 78 pages long, has a red cover on it. I've got a copy of it right here. And he basically just blasts, Bobby Kennedy for the kind of person he was. He writes the ruthlessness of this man, his utter disregard for the rights of others is frightening. He does not hesitate to try to embarrass and even disgrace the president and so on and so forth. He really gets after Bobby. But he, again, provides all of this documentation where Bobby stayed when he was in L.A. that summer, all of the different kinds of things that were going on. And so that book was released, and I have the FBI memos that they actually went ahead and got copies of it. They sent it to Bobby Kennedy saying, here's the allegations that are in the book. What are we going to do about it? Some of them apparently don't make any sense, but Mr. Kennedy, many of them we think probably are true about the love affair and so on and so forth that way. And what Dorothy would have done is the same thing that I did. I looked at that, and then I found an FBI memo that said basically that the Kennedys and members of the FBI were told, go out and buy as many copies of that book as you can, confiscate them, so nobody will be able to read the damn book. And that's what they did. And so, that shows how scared they were of this Capel book coming out that would have basically just, even in that day and age, without the internet and social media, it would have been big news and destroyed the careers of Bobby Kennedy and probably John Kennedy.
That's pretty wild, pretty groundbreaking, and there's a lot of documentation here in this book, as you point out. And again, if you're interested in this story of how Robert Kennedy might have been responsible for the death of Marilyn Monroe and how that decision and the handling of the aftermath of that Marilyn Monroe death may have actually led to the killing of President Kennedy and to the killing of Dorothy Kilgallen. Want to encourage you to check out the book Collateral Damage. You can get it at markshawbooks.com or wherever books are sold. It's out this week. It's brand new. Everybody is talking about it. When we come back, we're going to find out how that death of Marilyn Monroe might have led to the death of John F. Kennedy. If you have questions, we'll try and get to you as soon as we can. 1-800-848-9222. We're talking with Mark Shaw. He's the author of the book Collateral Damage, a best-selling author, attorney, investigative journalist. He is my guest for the hour. 1-800-848-9222. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Straight ahead.
77 WABC. It's The Other Side of Midnight. Best of. 77 WABC. It's The Other Side of Midnight. Best of.
George, you have a word here?
All right, Senator, this one's for the Democrats, so let's really hear it.
All right, I think I'm about as ready as I'm ever going to be.
Okay, stand by. This is Wild Thing. Take 72, Senator.
Wild Thing. You make my heart sing. You make everything groovy. Wild Thing. A Wild Thing. I think I love you.
This is Wild Thing, as sung by Senator Bobby. It was actually a novelty record that came out back in 1967. Comedian William Bill Minkin gave his best impression of Robert Kennedy doing Wild Thing. We've been talking with Mark Shaw. He's the author of a brand new book out this week, which everybody is talking about, called Collateral Damage. And in this book, he draws a pretty strong connection. It's all based on primary sources and authentic documents, a pretty strong connection between the death of Marilyn Monroe, the death of John F. Kennedy, and the death of Dorothy Kilgallen. All right. Mark, you explained how and why you believe that Robert Kennedy was responsible for the death of Marilyn Monroe. How, then, does the death of Marilyn Monroe lead to the death of John F. Kennedy in November of 1963?
Well, I lay out everything in the book like a prosecutor would. I've done that in the other books as well. And I did have an advantage here, and it's kind of an unusual one, if I may say so. I did this ass backwards, which I have done with a lot of things in my life. But if you think about it, you would first investigate Marilyn's death. She died first, then JFK, then Dorothy. Well, I had already investigated JFK's first and then Dorothy. And so then I decided to investigate Marilyn's. But instead of backfiring on me, that just opened up a great window, not only into what happened to Marilyn, but also what happened to JFK and Dorothy. And, you know, I'm a historian, so I'm looking at the historical aspects of this. And you've been saying, of course, and I understand why you want to, that Bobby Kennedy might have killed Marilyn Monroe. He did kill Marilyn Monroe. Now, that's figuratively speaking, but he was responsible for his death. For her death. The motive is just so strong there. Who else in the world would have wanted to stop her from going to the press with what, you know, not only the love affair, but also these matters of national security? So he was responsible. And then he got his good friend, William Parker, the police chief in Los Angeles, to cover it up by never investigating, never going to talk to witnesses, never doing anything with a staged death scene again. But what they did is Parker appointed three psychiatrists to a panel, and they looked at Marilyn's mental state before she died. Predictably, they came back and said that she was suicidal, and that was the end of the story. And so, you know, what I started to do is try to – it's like a giant jigsaw puzzle. But once I had figured out that Marilyn was obviously silenced because of what she knew, she was the actress too much who knew too much, just like Dorothy was the reporter who knew too much. Here's what I found. If Bobby Kennedy, and I'm going to go slow with this because I think it's very, very important to realize, and it'll give your listeners something to think about. If Bobby Kennedy would have been prosecuted in 1962 for the murder, the complicity in the murder of Marilyn Monroe, based on all of the evidence at the time, he would have had to have resigned as Attorney General. He would have been powerless. If you agree with that, that statement that I'm making, that conclusion, then you stretch it out, because if he was already powerless, then those mafioso, especially Carlos Marcello, who killed the president so Bobby would be powerless, would not have had to do that because he would have been already powerless. And then you can stretch that on into the fact that Dorothy Kilgallen in 1965 would have never have been silenced for what she knew about the JFK assassination, because there would have been no JFK assassination for her to have investigated. So collateral damage, the abuse of power, what Bobby Kennedy did, not only with persecution, I would call it, of the mafia, but then his involvement in Marilyn's death resulted in the deaths of JFK and then Dorothy Kilgallen.
Well, look, I mean, it does stand to reason if then, and it's a pretty logical sequence of events and makes a whole lot of sense. A lot of people have been eager to chat with you, and I've been monopolizing your time. If you want to call in with a question for Mark Shaw, you can do so, 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Joe in Queens has been patiently holding. Hello there, Joe.
Hey, Mark, very interesting stuff. First of all, Dorothy would have known as she was doing her investigation about the many people that had been witnesses or had something to do with, the periphery of the actual assassination had already been knocked off. So I wonder why she proceeded with all that. And if she had other confidence besides, say, her boyfriends, maybe people that had weren't players but were just friends where you could have gotten information. And then it sounds like the woman that was washing blood in the case of Marilyn Monroe's, I would ask also, did Marilyn have, besides Joe DiMaggio, did she still have a relationship with him? And, at the time, or other people that would have maybe known something about the trajectory she was on.
Good. Three questions. With JFK, and with Dorothy and with Marilyn, but especially JFK and Marilyn, I've gotten sick and tired, frankly, of all these rumors out there and the Wikipedia stuff and all that other kind of stuff about these two individuals and what happened to them. First of all, with JFK, Dorothy Kilgallen is the most credible reporter to have covered the JFK assassination. You can read her columns and everything that she wrote. The Oswald file must not close a few days after he died. Those are up on the DorothyKilgallenStory.org. So she was genuine, and she had, unfortunately, she told everybody when she got back to New York after New Orleans, I'm going to crack this case wide open and all that, and that cost her life. With Marilyn, Marilyn was portrayed as a dumb blonde. Well, she wasn't a dumb blonde. And, she was a voracious reader, for instance. I quote in the new book, there's a book about her called Fragments, and I give the cover in there and everything. She wrote poetry. She wrote little short stories. She wrote all kinds of things on hotel stationery and different things like that. For God's sake, she read Ulysses. I can't even read Ulysses. But she was mischaracterized that way, and that's always bothered me. And then they didn't know what happened to her when she died, just like they didn't know what happened to Dorothy. But I put the headline in there. You know what the headline was the day she died, the day after she died? Marilyn kills self. And it went into the drugs and all that. They just, just butchered these two women with these false rumors all of these years. And people may wonder, why am I interested in this? Well, I've become their voices. I found a quote that I keep by my writing table. The dead cannot obtain justice for themselves. It is the duty of the living to do it. And we must do that. We can't let these reputations of these two women, especially these remarkable women, be tarnished on and on and on and on. I've written a long letter now to the Los Angeles District Attorney, Los Angeles District Attorney, with a 300-page evidence report and the book and everything, and said, come on, please open up a reinvestigation. This woman does not deserve to be looked upon as somebody who committed suicide. Your second question. She had hoped right before she died that she might remarry Joe DiMaggio. They had kept in touch. I have a wonderful picture in the book of Marilyn and Joe DiMaggio Jr. They were very good friends. And all really Marilyn wanted to do in her life was have a child. And she hoped that that could happen. So, she lost that when she died. Dorothy lost being with her three children when she died and all the things she could have done in the future. JFK, look at him. He never was able to play with John and Caroline and all that. These are tragic deaths that took place, and they shouldn't have, and they wouldn't have, except for Bobby Kennedy's abuse of power and his, you know, falling in love with a woman and telling her he was going to divorce his wife and all of his children and everything else like that. And that's exactly what led to her death. So these were tragic deaths that should have never happened.
So obviously it makes sense that had this Marilyn Monroe murder never taken place, then there would never have been a need to kill John F. Kennedy. But is there, and there are going to be a lot of people that ask this, this is, I guess, an obvious question, is there any connection between Robert Kennedy's assassination and the death of Marilyn Monroe, John F. Kennedy, and Dorothy Kilgallen, or is that outside the scope of what you've looked at with respect to this book, Collateral Damage?
Well, one of the reasons I like to be on your program, Frank, and I appreciate it because, you know, we're able to make people stop and think out there about these kinds of things, and you ask great questions, and that's a great question. I wish I could connect Bobby Kennedy's death to the other three. I think they are connected. Look at this logic. Okay, so Bobby Kennedy, you know, knows, and he told his son that he knew it was Marcello who killed JFK. And so now Bobby is out of power. He's no longer attorney general. He's running for president in 68. Well, if you're Carlos Marcello and anybody that had anything to do with the JFK assassination, you can't let him become president because you know what's going to happen. He's going to come after you. So the motive is there. There's no question in my mind the motive is there. But I have not been able to connect either Sirhan Sirhan or the other gentleman that was with him that night in Los Angeles when RFK was killed. I can't connect them to Marcello or anybody in the mafia. I found at one point that Sirhan Sirhan had worked at the Hollywood racetrack. And so I tried to show that maybe Marcello and the mob were involved. But so far I can't. But logic tells me that there is a connection. And I would say again, as I do on many of these shows, if there are people out there who know anything about this, I get wonderful tips from people and follow them through. And a lot of that material's in the book. So if there's somebody out there that knows anything about that, I'd love to be able to connect it because I think they are connected, those four deaths.
Well, it makes sense to me. 1-800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. Talking with Mark Shaw about the deaths of Marilyn Monroe, John F. Kennedy, and Dorothy Kilgallen. I have to take one more break. We'll continue with your calls next. This is The Other Side of Midnight, 800-848-WABC. Straight ahead.
77 WABC. It's The Other Side of Midnight, best of. 77 WABC. It's The Other Side of Midnight. Best of.
And now the end is near, and so I face the final curtain. My friend, I'll say it clear, I'll state my case, which I'm certain. I've lived a life that's full.
The great Frank Sinatra singing My Way. By the way, if you're a Sinatra fan, you've got to listen to my friend Joe Piscopo every Sunday night from 6 to 9 doing Ramsey Mazda's Sunday with Sinatra. I was listening last night as Rachel and I were driving back from Long Island. Great show. A terrific, terrific show if you're a Sinatra fan. Sinatra, also a contemporary of Marilyn Monroe and the Kennedys. And a number of sources suggest that he had a little bit of animosity towards the Kennedys for their treatment of Marilyn Monroe. We've been talking with Mark Shaw. You've got to check out his new book if you're interested in any of this stuff. It's called Collateral Damage, and it explores the death of Marilyn Monroe. The full title is Collateral Damage, The Mysterious Deaths of Marilyn Monroe and Dorothy Kilgallen and the Ties That Bind Them to Robert Kennedy and the JFK Assassination. We're going to take your calls for the remaining few minutes that we have, Mark, with us. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Diana is here in New York City. Diana, you're on with Mark Shaw.
Hi, Frank. Wonderful show, as always.
Thank you.
I'd be curious to know Mr. Shaw's thought about the following. That is that I heard Gianni Russo, your friend, interviewed corroborating everything that Mr. Shaw is saying, and further saying that Marilyn told Robert, whether or not it was true, that she told him that she was pregnant with his child. I'd be curious to know if Mr. Shaw has any information about that.
Mark, and I know you've been a guest on Johnny Russo's podcast as well, so whatever you have to say on that end, the floor is yours.
Well, Johnny Russo, I'm telling you, now there are people who are going to be skeptical of what he said in his book, Hollywood Godfather, but it's a terrific book. He's really filled in a lot of holes with regard to what happened, both to Marilyn, who he knew at an early age back in New York City there, and then his knowledge of what happened to her when she died, and on into the you know more into really the connections with the Kennedys and so on and so forth that way. So I have a lot of respect for him. Yes, he has said that Marilyn supposedly could have been pregnant at the time. I have never been able to find credible evidence any place that that happened. Now, you know, that said, back in that day, it very well could have been secluded from anybody learning. I tried to check hospital records in the area and different things like that, but nothing has come to mind that that proves that it happened, and who it was with or whatever that way. So I've basically just gone with evidence. I don't like to speculate, so I've gone with the evidence that I could prove.
Thank you, Diana. Let me ask you this, Mark. All of this happened more than 60 years ago. Obviously, we have a lot of problems here in the year 2021, right? I mean, nationally, internationally, locally, there's a lot that we need to be concerned about fixing. Why is this still so important? Why should large police departments like the NYPD, like the LAPD, spend time investigating crimes that happened more than 60 years ago when almost everybody involved in these incidents has already passed on?
Well, it's all about history and correcting distortions of history, but it's also about justice. Neither these women or JFK, in my opinion, got justice when they died. Their reputations were all tarnished and all of that. And again, I like to look at it like, okay, if these cases happened 2 days ago, they would be thoroughly investigated. They're victims of a crime. And so as victims of a crime, they are entitled to investigations of their death. And so it shouldn't make any difference that it was 60 years ago, especially with regard to both of these women and even JFK. With what happened to them. We need to clarify that, and those responsible need to be held accountable. This Ron Pataki, who I believe leaked Dorothy Kilgallen's evidence for the JFK assassination of the wrong people, he's still around, and I hope Philip Panzarella of the Cold Case Squad will investigate him. Bobby Kennedy, I know there's a lot of people out there that love the Kennedys, you know, and the Camelot and all this other kind of stuff. And in fact, I you know, when I started this, I was a little reluctant to write it because – yeah, you know, he probably saved us from a nuclear war with Cuba, his brother Jack, you know, with civil rights and all of that kind of thing. But they were bad guys in a lot of ways. They were serial womanizers, just like their father. And then there's no question in my mind, and if anybody wants to debate me about this, I'd be glad to do it any place. Bobby Kennedy was responsible for Marilyn Monroe's death. You could prove it in a case of law with a first-year prosecutor based on all the evidence that I have. So he needs to be held accountable. And that's what I'm hoping I'm hoping we're going to find the truth about this. I was on a show the other night, and I was privileged that the host said, you know, Mark, hopefully what you have presented here will you know, cure a wound that we've had in this country, that the disinformation about JFK's death, about Dorothy's death, but especially about Marilyn's as well. And as a historian, that's my job.
Mark, do you believe, understanding that you've made the case that Robert Kennedy ordered the killing of Marilyn Monroe, do you believe that John F. Kennedy was also complicit or at least in the know about Robert Kennedy's decision to kill Marilyn Monroe?
Well, again, an excellent question. I can't speculate. I don't know, but it's hard to believe. You know, Jean Kennedy Smith, his JFK's sister, knew about it. Everybody knew about it. And yet, you know, they tried to button it up by, you know, closing out the case without any investigation and all that. But it's really hard to believe that, you know, that he wouldn't have known that something happened there. You know, I've sent both my of my books about Dorothy Kilgallen to Caroline Kennedy, and I'll send this one to her, saying to her, you know, at least read the book. And, you know, you could put a stop to all of these rumors about exactly what happened. And with this particular book, I'm telling you right now, Bobby Kennedy was responsible for your father's death. And if he would have been, you know, prosecuted for Marilyn's death, that would have never happened. So, you know, why don't you, she it's never responded to me or anybody else. She could come clean and, you know, come out there and say, you know, based on all the evidence that's been presented now, this is what happened to my father. And boy, would that make such a difference. So I'm calling on her to do that. Why doesn't she do that and put to rest all of these rumors? If I'm wrong about everything I've said, then say that too. But just don't hide in the shadows about this. History needs you to come forward and you know, give us an indication of what you think happened in back in 1960.
You know, it's tough to argue with that. Mark, the hour has flown by. Unfortunately, we're just out of time. Oh, you got to come back. There's a whole lot of other information that's in this book, Collateral Damage. I want to encourage people to buy it. They can get it at markshawbooks.com. They can get it at Amazon. Collateral Damage, The Mysterious Deaths of Marilyn Monroe and Dorothy Kilgallen and the Ties That Bind Them to Robert Kennedy and the JFK Assassination. Mark, congratulations on an incredible effort on this book. And let's hope you're able to get some justice for some people that have been without it for far too long.
Frank, you're a good man. Thanks so much for having me on the program. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Mark Shaw, check him out again, markshawbooks.com. Pretty groundbreaking. Next hour, we'll have an opportunity to take more of your calls, 1-800-848-9222. Any subject is fair game. We'll get into the mayor's race as well. In the 4 o'clock hour, yesterday was the 77th anniversary of D-Day, one of the most remarkable military adventures in history. We're going to get into that and a whole lot more. Until next hour, in the words of the great Barry Farber, keep asking questions.
77 WABC. It's the Other Side of Midnight. Best of.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
This is the Best of the Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano. 77 WABC.
This is the Other Side of Midnight. Good morning. It's Frank Morano here. It's Monday morning, Flag Day. Hopefully you're celebrating Flag Day the right way. Other than putting out a flag, I'm not really sure what you're supposed to do. But hopefully whatever you're doing, you're getting into the spirit of the holiday. So recently, I had the opportunity to be an eyewitness to a conversation between two fascinating individuals who come from different walks of life, different ages, different ethnic backgrounds, different educational backgrounds, different professional backgrounds, and different outlooks on life. And I was so captivated watching these two gentlemen hash out world events and things that were happening from the mundane to the super serious. I thought, well, it might be fun to have the two of them on the radio together. So let me welcome both of the guests that are going to be joining us for this hour. First, Sherrod Small, very well-known stand-up comic and the host of the podcast Race Wars. Sherrod, yes. Good morning. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Frankie. I'm happy to be here.
Very quickly, tell folks about Race Wars. What's that all about?
Well, we talk about pretty much everything under the sun, but we are focused on race and, like, you know, trying to bring people together. So we have everybody on the show from Ann Coulter to Artie Lang. And just trying to, you know, find some middle ground with people.
Can't help but notice I've never been invited on that particular program.
Yeah, I need you on there. Anytime.
You rarely, I heard Howard Stern say this recently, you rarely end up in a better place by commenting on race. I'm sure I'd come on and say something that's going to get me in trouble.
No, it's a safe place. I'm telling you, it's like a safe haven where you're going to say, that speak freely. It's like it's all coming from love.
All right, well, I'll throw the N-word around liberally then once I get on there. How do people listen to it?
They go to Patreon. Patreon.com/racewars.
Catch it right there. And now you've been around a while as a comic.
Yes, sir.
You've done a lot of things. People might have seen you on television or some of the other things that you've done. And if people want to learn more about you or your background to see you, they can go to smallworldcomedy.com.
That's right. That's the website.
And I also want to welcome back a gentleman who I've been lucky enough to interview before, one of the brightest legal minds in the country today. He is the host of the radio show For the People. He is a retired California Superior Court judge and author of the book From the Trench to the Bench, Navigating the Legal System and Finding Your Spiritual Path Along the Way, Judge Herb Dodell from the Left Coast. Judge Dodell, it's great to talk with you again. Thanks for staying up late with us.
It's like the middle of the night for you guys.
Yeah.
Well, it's morning for us. It's middle of the night for you, but we're all sleep-deprived regardless, whether it's morning or evening. It's great to talk with you both. So, Judge, let me begin with you. I saw this article this weekend, which really I found really interesting from a legal perspective. And before we get and you know what, we'll take your questions. If people want to call in for Sherrod and the judge, they're ready to take on any issue in the news, any legal issue, any cultural issue, any race issue, you name it. These guys are ready to tackle it. If you have questions, 800-848-9222, 1-800-848-WABC. But this is a story that really caught my mind, Judge. A judge dismisses a Houston, or as we New Yorkers like to say, Houston, hospital workers lawsuit over this vaccine mandate. So a federal judge in Texas dismissed this lawsuit brought by employees of Houston Methodist Hospital.
117 nurses.
117 nurses who challenged the hospital's COVID vaccination requirements. So before we bring Sherrod in, Judge, give me your take from a legal perspective. Was Judge Hughes's ruling in this case, striking down this lawsuit, was that sound on a legal basis?
Well, I haven't read all the papers and the briefs that were filed in connection with the case, so I shouldn't really comment necessarily on the factual basis. But it brings to play a very common question. People ask me all the time, can the government force us to take a vaccination?
Right.
And the answer is maybe. But they don't do it in a direct way. They basically say if you don't take the vaccination, you can't get into the ballgame or whatever it is. So you're left with a choice. But the question, the underlying question is, can they force you to take a vaccination? And the answer is there's really no definitive answer. And I suppose it depends on the circumstances. If you look at the Constitution, and I always look at the Constitution, if you look at the preamble, it says states, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. That's pretty broad language.
Right.
So what one could certainly argue, and I guess it really depends on what judge you get, too, certainly could argue that this is to ensure domestic tranquility because of the risk of not being vaccinated, and certainly is to promote the general welfare of the country. Can they force you to? It's almost analogous to what's going on with regard to criminal arrests, search and seizure issues. Oftentimes, the police are going to want to take a DNA sample. Can they force you to do that? In some cases, yes, they can. By statute, the officers are allowed to do that. They do it pretty much in drunk driving cases, or what you oftentimes hear is a DUI. Happens all the time.
So let me, Judge, let me bring in Sherrod on the issue of mandatory vaccinations in general and this Houston case specifically. Sherrod, what was your take?
It was fascinating to see that the judge just immediately shot down their comparison to the Nazi Germany thing, because she even spoke about that in her brief.
The plaintiff.
Yes, and she just said it was just a bad idea to even take that route, because you're not being coerced, you're not being forced by Methodist Hospital. It's like they're doing this for the safety of the patients and the employees. So that's why I think they just threw it out. I thought it was silly. assembly in the first place.
So you don't think that there's anything wrong with an employer mandating that their workers, especially healthcare workers, get vaccinated?
I don't think so. And I don't think that they were like trying to use them as experiments at the beginning of all this. I think they were trying to make it healthy and safe for all the people coming into the hospital.
Well, what if they were to do, and I don't know the particulars of this Houston Methodist Hospital policy here, but it does appear that if you've had the disease and recovered from it,
right,
you have immunity for some time, maybe even a lifetime. What if you had a nurse that had the disease,
right,
recovered from it, has immunity, and doesn't want to take the vaccine? Why should that person be forced to take the vaccine just to keep their job?
Well, I think they can still catch the disease if they have the antibodies. And plus, you can be an asymptomatic carrier of it even without, you know, with the antibodies. So I think it's just a safer way to do it. But even in like comedy clubs now, you got to bring a vaccine card to get in. And into the clubs. And plus, the employees there, they have to get shots before they can return to work. So is that being coerced?
Well, Judge, you talked about the kind of carrot and stick approach that employers and government entities have been utilizing, saying if you want to go to the ball game, you got to get vaccinated. Why do the people that have recovered from this disease not enjoy the same privileges as the vaccinated?
I think that's a distinguishing factor that has to be considered by whoever the judge was.
Yeah.
But the reality is you're giving the employee, because this is an employment issue now, you're giving the employee an option. You're saying, okay, if you take the shots, you can continue to work here. If you don't take the shots, we're going to have to terminate you. So it gets into the real question of what are the legal bases for terminating an employee.
Right.
Can you terminate an employee? And I wanted to talk about, because I thought it would be interesting, about cancel culture, because that's basically what's going on in many places.
Right. I think so far they didn't terminate anyone. I think 176 employees got suspended. So are they just in limbo? How does that work?
That's a distinction without a difference. The fact is that you have to determine whether or not they're being paid, what
right.
their status is, and the rest. But if you make it voluntary, you can continue to work here or not. I think you take the sting out of a lot of the arguments that you must do it. And in cancel culture, when you're talking about that, for example, let's say you're an employer and you've got like 6 or 7 employees,
mm-hmm.
and you're a very far to the left progressive, as they refer to themselves, and you have an employee who is a big Trumper.
Yeah, like the MyPillow guy?
And it bothers you. So you say, you know what? I'm firing you. Can they do that? What do you think, Sherrod?
I don't think
you should be able to fire?
I don't think so. I think you have the right to, you know, vote or support whoever you want politically without jeopardizing your job and your employment.
Well, what if, let me give you this scenario, as both of you, what if, for instance, like this is a radio station with a primarily conservative audience, right?
Right.
And, you know, what if there's a radio talk show host that doesn't like Donald Trump, thinks he's the worst president of all time, and they're speaking to an audience that's primarily very pro-Trump, should that host be able to get fired for his political beliefs and expressing them on the radio?
Well, I think the ratings should tell the tale. I mean, if people are tuning in, then keep him. But if he's not making the ratings, then, yeah, you got to terminate.
Yeah. Judge, is that a view that you share?
Well, I don't look at it from the economic standpoint, but I'm looking at it from a free speech standpoint.
Uh-huh.
You know, the First Amendment is basically under attack right now, more so than I can remember in the recent past. And there's a distinction between free speech and the old expression about yelling fire in a crowded theater, et cetera, et cetera. But the reality is free speech is free speech. And in the Brandenburg versus Ohio case, the United States Supreme Court case, the Supreme Court held you pretty much can't stop people from saying anything, but there are some exceptions. If, in fact, free speech is to incite someone to riot and saying, we'll meet you at the bar at 11 o'clock and bring your flag, or whatever it may be, that's a lot different than just saying the government could be overthrown by force and violence, and you're expressing that as an opinion. So every case is really different. And it was kind of interesting. I just reread today a case in California where I practiced and where I was on the bench. Is a case called Evans versus Evans.
Oh.
And in that case, the husband was a deputy sheriff, and he was trying to get a restraining order against his wife. And let me just preface that by saying, I presided over restraining order cases for about 5 years, so that was where I had a lot of experience. And the question was, she was saying terrible things about him to lots of different people. He wanted to stop her.
Uh-huh.
And so the question was, could he stop her? The court in that case basically said that the order was too broad, but in reading the language, it says if under the right circumstances, if she was threatening to disclose confidential information, for example, she could be enjoined, and that would be permissible. So that kind of leaves the door open factually under what circumstances is a party seeking to do something to curb or to allow for the propagation of free speech. So I think pretty much you're seeing the same thing right now.
How did you rule, though? How did you rule in that case?
I didn't have that case. It wasn't my case.
Oh, it wasn't your case. Okay.
But I will tell you about a couple of my cases because I thought they were very interesting, and I wanted to make this show a little bit more entertaining than just...
Believe me, we appreciate that. Thank you.
Well, I want to tell you a story. We'll get back to the subject in a minute. The story is that clients will call lawyers for all purposes, for all reasons, at all times. And this is a story about a guy who was sentenced to die in the electric chair in South Carolina. Now, that they still use the electric chair in South Carolina. And the execution was scheduled for midnight. At 5 minutes to 12, the phone rings, and it's the client saying, look, they shaved my hair. They gave me a last meal. And it's walking me down the hallway with a minister. What should I do? You know what the answer was?
What's that?
Don't sit down.
That's not bad. See, with you, Judge, we don't see it coming. We didn't have the rim shot ready.
I prepared a couple of them because I thought they were entertaining. And if the subject came up, I wanted to be able to somehow put a little light on it as opposed to just facts.
In just a minute, I want to ask you both a little bit about social media censorship and where that leaves us.
Right.
As it stands now, President Trump still banned from Facebook and Instagram and various social media platforms. We'll talk about that as well as a number of other issues. We will tackle your questions. If you have questions for Sherrod Small or Judge Herbert Dodell related to legal issues, cultural issues, race issues, you name it, these guys are ready to tackle your questions on anything. 1-800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222.
77 WABC. It's the Other Side of Midnight. Best of. 77 WABC. It's the Other Side of Midnight. Best of.
This is the Other Side of Midnight. Those are the Doobie Brothers singing Keeps You Running. Now that New York has legalized recreational marijuana, you'll be seeing a lot more of those Doobies all around town. We're joined for the hour by very well-known stand-up comic and podcast host Sherrod Small.
You could...
Which doobie you be? From what's happening.
You can catch him on Race Wars, a very popular podcast, and by Judge Herb Dodell, a retired California Superior Court judge and author of the book From the Trench to the Bench, Navigating the Legal System and Finding Your Spiritual Path Along the Way. Judge, very quickly, what will people learn in your book if they get the book From the Trench to the Bench? What's it all about?
Well, it's basically about how do you deal with the legal system for people who don't know anything about it. Most people think that the legal system works in a particular way. They go to a courtroom, they see the judge on the bench, the bailiff, etc. But they don't know what goes on in the back room. They have no idea what goes on among the judges. They have no idea why judges make rulings that they make. What do you do if you get arrested at 3 o'clock in the morning, and how do you get out? What do you do if you get sued or you have to sue somebody? You need to go to small claims court, you're about to be evicted, whatever. People don't understand the system at all.
I agree.
And many people are really penalized by it. And I tell this story all the time. Sherrod and I have done a number of shows together, so he's already heard the story. This is a very, very famous basketball player, NBA. Got the rings, the whole deal. And I liked him. One day I was sitting in what they call unlawful detainer. Unlawful detainer are foreclosures and evictions. Not my favorite place. But that's what I was sitting in that day. And I was reading the files in chambers before I came out. And the bailiff came in. He said to me, you know who's out there? I said, no, who's out there? I see the list of all the people. I didn't recognize anybody. He said, look at that name. And the minute I looked at it, I recognized who it was. I'm a big basketball fan. I said, oh, is he out there? Yeah. I said, do you have a lawyer? I don't think so. So I came out, and I said to him, do you have a lawyer? He says, no, I don't. Now, I knew from my experience and having been certified in the area that he had a potential defense. He was about to be thrown out of his $7 million house. He was about to be evicted, and I was up to me to decide whether he was going to be evicted or not. And the reality was, I knew he had a potential defense. I knew because I had seen it once before, and I had called the presiding judge to see if I could do it. So I had the authority, and I said to him, is there a reason why you haven't got a lawyer? He says, I just don't have a lawyer. And I couldn't tell him, because you can't give advice to any of the litigants, you know. Obviously, if you do that, you're choosing sides. So I couldn't tell him that he had a potential defense. So I tried to help him out. He was a nice guy. I tried to help him out. I said, look, I'm going to stay the execution of this for 2 weeks. Come back in 2 weeks, and I suggest you get a lawyer. And so 2 weeks went by. He comes back in. I said, okay, do you have a lawyer? No.
So those are the stories. Those are the stories that people can hear in From the Trench to the Bench. Sherrod, let me get your take on what we're seeing now in terms of social media. There's been a lot of criticism of some of the big tech companies. They enjoy this Section 230 protection.
Right.
And there's been a lot of allegations that they're a bit inconsistent in their enforcement of their own guidelines. A lot of supporters of President Trump think that by prohibiting him from being on Facebook, which he's now banned until at least January of 2023, as well as Instagram and Twitter, that is big tech's attempt to put the thumb on the scale of the 2022 elections and the 2024 elections and sort of silent President Trump. Give me your take on social media censorship in general and the Trump situation specifically.
I think it's kind of dangerous, just giving Facebook and Instagram and Twitter all this power. But there are private companies, so they have control over who's using their product. But if you're using their product to incite riots, and this is what they determined that President Trump did, then they have the right to pull you off of there. But it's just confusing to me because who's making that decision at these companies? Who's in charge of that? It's scary. It's scary to just know that these people hold so much power over what we get to hear now.
Well, some people are saying for that very reason, they should not get to enjoy that Section 230 protection, that Congress should step in and either break them up or regulate them so that they don't get to enjoy that immunity from lawsuits that, say, telephone companies enjoy.
Right. I think I don't know if he's going to go in that direction. I think he's going to stay just like the telephone companies have it now.
Mm-hmm.
But I just think that we just need to have more insight and transparency on how these decisions are made.
Judge, any thoughts on social media censorship in general and the Trump situation specifically?
Actually, I do, because there are legal principles that are involved. It's not as very simple, just a fact situation. The question really is, if you have a small company, for example, forget about Facebook and Twitter for the moment. Okay. You're a small company, and you want to do certain things a certain way. Does the government have the ability to step in and tell you how to run your business?
Right.
It's a private business. You raise money. Either it's a public company and you raise money in the market, or it's just a privately held company. When does the government have the ability to step in and tell you what to do? Because that's 1984.
But we still have like FDA and we have things like that that still tell companies what to do that the government runs.
Yeah, but that probably comes under this language that I read from the preamble to the Constitution. It's so broad, it depends on who your judges are, because these are appellate issues. And as I was going to say before, you don't know what's going to happen in any particular case. I tell people all the time, when I was practicing full-time, I'd say, okay, who's your judge going to be? And they would say, I have no idea who it is. I said, but do you make any difference? Well, yeah. I said, but you don't know who it is, do you? No. So in other words, you're taking a chance. Judge A is terrific. He loves the world, and he's very generous. Judge B, she's not so terrific. She's nasty and rude and whatever it is. You don't know who you're going to get. It's all about a crapshoot.
But how do you even find out? Where do you get that information?
You can't. Although in some cases when you first file a complaint, they tell you who your judge is going to be, and you have a certain amount of time to disqualify that judge in California. For no reason, you can disqualify one judge, one time only, and it has to be done pretty quick.
Right.
But generally speaking, you don't know anything about those people who are sitting on the bench. You have no clue. Whether I was once accused by my clerk when I was sitting in Beverly Hills. She says, you know, you're a softy, because I gave some lady a couple of weeks' extension. I didn't want to throw her out between Christmas and New Year's, so she'd have to live in a car. And so I gave her an additional couple of weeks, which was within my authority. When I was getting off the bench, my clerk said, you know, you're a softy. I said, well, maybe I am. And maybe some others would have done something different. She said, you know, our regular judge, because I was sitting in for a guy.
Yeah.
She said, our regular judge would never have granted it. I said, well, I'm not your regular judge. I'm the judge for today. And I had the authority to do it, and I'm going to do it. Whether I'm a softie or not makes no difference at the end of the day. And so I tell people all the time, because of the uncertainties in the legal system, and there's uncertainties now as to whether or not the government can control business operations. Then you get into the argument of free speech. Do they have a right to say whatever they want to say? And the cases have been very, very clear. You can pretty much say whatever you want to say. That's the Brandenburg case. As long as you're not inciting violence. That may be one of the reasons that they took him off, because of the Capitol and insurrection and whatever. But each of these cases is going to have a separate fact pattern.
Right. Well, I mean, as of now, I mean, everybody has a right to say what they want. They have free speech rights, but you don't have a right to be on Facebook.
Right.
As Sherrod pointed out, it is a private company. So.
Well, it's an interesting issue, because there's going to be, already has been, discussions about breaking up the big tech companies for just the very same reason. And Sherrod is absolutely right. We usually have very lively conversations. And the bottom line is, you don't know in advance what's going to happen with big tech. And you don't know who's going to be in that room, whether there's even a room. Yeah. A couple of people sitting around saying, I don't like that guy. Let's cut him off. That when does it become arbitrary and capricious? Those are the magic words, by the way, arbitrary and capricious.
800-848-WABC. Let me say hello to Larry in Long Island. Larry, what is your question?
How can we get our employees in Congress to follow the basics? For example, the 13th Amendment bans involuntary servitude. Servitude is defined as providing a service or a product, a legal service or a product such as apple pies. Now, when Congress forces people into involuntary servitude, why isn't that banned?
Well, what kind of involuntary servitude are you talking about, Larry? Are you talking about prison or jury service or something else?
Any kind of involuntary servitude. Now, one of my favorites is how a body with a life of 2 years, like Congress, can issue 30-year debt, forcing children into involuntary servitude of the debt payments.
All right. Anybody want to tackle this one? It's above my pay grade.
Take it on, Sherrod. For you.
I think he's right. Dumb Congress coming in for 2 years and sticking out kids with all these bills. Like, we ain't going to leave them with enough bills ourselves as parents.
I'm with you guys on that one, actually. 800-848-9222. We'll continue with you. Well, I'll squeeze in one more. E. Frank is in Astoria. Hello, E. Frank.
Yes, I want to ask both gentlemen, do you think there's going to be any form of reform in the judicial system and the court systems in regards to the torts, that's civil lawsuits?
Judge?
I don't think so. Too many people have too many interests that are diverse and want to maintain the status quo. That's why a lot of things don't get done. One of the potential solutions, and it's been bandied around before, is term limits.
Yeah.
Because these guys and these gals are interested in one thing when they get elected for the first time. What do you think that is, Sherrod?
Re-election.
Exactly right. They're interested in re-election. And if they think that they're going to get somebody on the other side angry at them and it's going to affect their ability to get reelected, they ain't going to do it. And these people can't get along, and that's why I'm concerned about where we're heading. Do I think they're going to reform the judicial system? Probably not, unless the Democrats decide, if they have the ability, to pack the court and more justices.
Right.
But that probably is unworkable now because you have one, the strongest, you know who the strongest senator is right now?
Joe Manchin.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
He holds the power of the United States Senate in his hands. He doesn't go along with the Democrats, they don't get anything passed. If they don't do something with the filibuster,
yeah,
they're not even going to get to 50. Even if they eliminated the filibuster, they still don't have 50 votes. So do I think anything is going to happen? Probably not. These people haven't done anything in 10 years. I don't see them waking up all of a sudden. I think one of the biggest problems, of course, is that the parties are so polarized that the so far left is so far from the far, far right that they don't know how to compromise.
So what do you...
There's an effort being made now for the infrastructure. But the bottom line is, I don't think they're going to reform anything.
So how do you think all this voting, all the stuff they're doing with these voting laws in all these states are going to affect the courts, or the courts going to affect these decisions?
Well, I did a kind of an analysis myself, just to kind of ask myself the same question. And you look at the Constitution. I'm a strict constructionist when it comes to the Constitution. To me, it says what it says, and that's what we have to follow. And we take an oath to do that. And the reality is that if you look at the Constitution, Article 6, Clause 2, it's called the Supremacy Clause. And if you look at the 10th Amendment, it talks about powers being given to the federal government and the states. So the bottom line is, are elections a state or a federal matter?
Yeah.
Because it's known as preemption. In many situations, if there's a dichotomy between the states and the feds take over because they have priority.
Let me ask you to pause there, Judge. We're going to continue in just a minute with Sherrod Small, comedian and podcast host. You can check out his podcast, Race Wars. You can also listen to Judge Herb Dodell on the For the People radio show. He's also the author of the book, From the Trench to the Bench, Navigating the Legal System and Finding Your Spiritual Path Along the Way. This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Moreno. We'll take your calls next, 800-848-WABC, 1-800-848-9222. Straight ahead.
77 WABC. It's The Other Side of Midnight. Best of. 77 WABC. It's The Other Side of Midnight. Best of.
Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Moreno, joined in studio by comedian and podcaster Sherrod Small.
Yes.
And on the phone from the left coast by retired California Superior Court Judge Herb Dodell. Sherrod, aside from the senator, Sherrod Brown,
yeah,
I've never met anybody in my life or never heard of anyone in my life with the name Sherrod. What kind of name is that?
Just a name. I mean, you know Mike Sherrod. You remember a football player?
Yeah, yeah.
But that was the last name. Yeah, but
different.
I knew other Sherrods growing up. Like
who are you named for?
I think it's just my mother's imagination.
Interesting.
but
interesting.
It's just a name that she enjoyed and she liked, so...
Yeah, it is interesting to me, Judge, that you and Sherrod seem to get along so well. I know you've been on one another's shows,
yeah,
and you kind of do this traveling show of the two of you, this sort of media odd couple. explain to me how this relationship germinated between the two of you.
Well, actually, I was invited on Sherrod's show in New York, and I was on the same, I guess you call it a panel, with Ann Coulter. So we kind of got into conversations, and we found that we had mutual interests. And so one day I invited him to be on my show. When he did, it was kind of lively. We didn't necessarily agree, which we don't always necessarily agree.
Right.
And then I went back and did his show again, and he did my show. So we decided what a great couple we make, because here he is. He's an urban guy, hip, young,
handsome
from the city.
Yeah, you notice he didn't mention handsome. I think he omitted that for a reason. Clearly,
versus the older guy, conservative, I suppose, in some ways. I'm not a Democrat. I'm not a Republican. I'm basically a moderate. And right. I would talk about the legal issues, and he would talk about the emotional issues and how he felt about it. And I would ask him questions, kind of loaded questions, actually.
Yeah.
And he would give me an answer, and I would kind of take the opposite view and provide him with legal principles to support whatever the position was. Just devil's advocate. So we got along really well, and we still get along real well. We just did a whole show on the George Floyd trial.
Yeah.
We talked about that. We didn't necessarily agree about some of those things either, but we did. And we kind of like you're right, it's the odd couple.
Yeah, it's interesting, though.
I think he's Felix.
I'm the clean one. I think, of course, the judge has been the establishment pretty much for a long time. So it's interesting to see his take on, the judicial system and the behind-the-scenes stuff that we don't have access to, that he had access to for decades. And these stories that he has, I'm telling you, some are scary, some are fascinating, and they all insightful.
Well, and you have a fan in my early morning news co-anchor, Juliette Huddy, Sherrod. She used to come on with her
I love Juliette.
All the time.
Yes.
She's a fan of yours as well.
Yes, so. I love her. Tell her I said hi.
800-848-9222 if you want to call in with a question or a comment for Judge Dodell and Sherrod Small, 800-848-WABC. We're going to cover a wide variety of issues. I do want to say hello to Russell in White Plains. Russell, what's on your mind?
Well, hi, Judge, and the gentleman, Sherrod. He sounds like a black Sid Rosenberg to us out here.
I can see that, actually.
Yeah, he sounds really interesting.
You know what? Sid has been doing a lot of tanning. Sid is actually darker than Sherrod.
I'm the light-skinned Sid.
I'm glad to hear you have a very interesting voice. I would like to know if the judge or Sherrod could comment on ranked choice voting, because it did come up earlier, and I think it's just the way that people refuse to choose. That's why they like fascists and they like authoritarians to tell them what to do. But in fact, it can be perceived, ranked choice voting can be perceived as voter suppression, because a lot of dumb people, they resent being bystanders, and people like Frank, who are engaged citizens, make others feel like bystanders, and that's you, Charlie.
All right. Anybody want to weigh in? Is ranked choice voting
that's
voter
what we're doing
suppression?
In New York? Is that what we're doing in New York now? You pick the one, two, three,
you rank
four.
Your choices. It's not voter suppression.
I mean,
it's ranking your choice.
But how does that work exactly? Like, so what if you get, like, the most number twos?
Well, you don't even look at the number twos if somebody has a majority. So if anybody has 50% plus one of first choice votes, that's it. The election's over, right? If nobody has a majority of first choice votes, then we take the person that had the least number of votes, and everybody that ranked that candidate first, we go to that voter's second choice, and it gets added to the first round.
Whoa.
So now we see, all right, does anybody have a majority now? We take a look. Now someone does. That person's the nominee. But if you get the most number twos or the most number threes, that doesn't necessarily mean anything. Unless it all depends on
if you get
the existing rankings.
Okay. So do you think it's going to be an issue in New York's mayoral race? Because I think it is.
I think whoever loses will make sure it's an issue.
It's going to be the last time we do it.
Any thoughts on the caller's question about voter suppression or anything like that?
Well, I can talk about elections because I was asked that question. And by the way, I'm from Tuckahoe, so I'm pretty close to White Plains. If you look at the Constitution, Section 5 says each house shall be the judge of the elections, returns, and qualifications, etc. That sounds like the federal government has an interest. And if you apply the preemption clauses, the supremacy clauses, that would mean that they could, if they could get together with each other, they could override or overrule some of these state laws that are being passed now, which are definitely designed for purposes of suppression.
Yes, the black vote. They're trying to keep the black and brown vote down.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right, because that vote traditionally goes Democratic.
Yeah.
That's what they're trying to do. That's why these legislators.
Yeah. Well, I want to be clear that that has nothing to do with ranked choice voting.
No, I don't know anything about ranked choice because I'm in California.
Well, that puts you in the company of many of the people that call me on a daily basis. All right, a little bit of news.
The Other Side of Midnight proudly presents breaking news.
It is my sad duty to report that actor Ned Beatty, who you may remember from the film Network, the film Deliverance, All the President's Men, even Superman, has passed away, unfortunately, at the age of 83. A prolific acting career that spanned more than four decades and earned him an Oscar nomination for my favorite role that he was ever involved in the movie Network. He was he has passed away at the age of 83. Sorry to see that. I never got to speak with Mr. Beatty, never knew Mr. Beatty, but certainly was always a fan of his work. He has passed away at the age of 83. Sherrod, anything you want to add on the passing of Ned Beatty?
He was a great character actor. But I know it's going to be a lot of tweeting of squeal like a pig today.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know
oh,
it's going to be. It's going to light up Twitter.
I know you're out there in Hollywood, Judge. Did you ever have occasion to interact with Ned Beatty?
No, I never did, actually. I was an entertainment lawyer, by the way, for many years in my early part of my career. So I did talk to actors and things like that, but never spoke to Ned Beatty.
We're going to continue with your calls for Judge Herb Dodell and comedian Sherrod Small, 800-848-WABC. Tom is in the Boogie Down Bronx. Tom, what's on your mind?
Well, it's my old complaint. Having taught for 1 year in a public school system and then quitting, I wanted to ask the judge's feelings about a comment made by Attorney General former William Barr. And he was asking him about systemic racism, and he says, well, the closest thing I could point to is the public school system. And I agree with him wholeheartedly. The inner cities are predominantly, and I'm from the Bronx, predominantly black and Hispanic, and they are such failing, underperforming schools that you can't even find regular, you know, decent jobs. That's where they bring in the minimum wage up to 15, a livable wage. Wanted to hear what the judge thinks about
that. All right,
Judge,
you want to start with that one?
But that's endemic across the country. I don't think it's limited to New York City. Public schools never been provided with a lot of money. Teachers have always been vastly underpaid,
yeah.
Terribly underpaid.
My mother was a public school teacher for 30, 35 years, and she used to buy books and like pencils and notebooks for all her classes. Like
that's
the kids just didn't have it.
That's why a lot of people really strive to send their kids to private schools.
Yeah.
Or Catholic schools.
That's what I went
to a
Catholic school.
A lot of people went to Catholic school because they thought they'd get a better education than they were going to get at PS80 or wherever they were. PS80, by the way, is in the Bronx. And the reality is, unless there's money to be given on a priority basis, very little is going to change. People pick priorities, like building a new road or putting up one thing or another. It's a lot of politics involved here, and there's also a lot of union issues involved here, too.
Right.
And so I think that there's very little likelihood that anything is really going to change with regard to the providing of education.
But the weird thing about New York public schools, too, is that some schools that are public are really great schools and hard to get in. And you can find some of these schools on, like, in more expensive neighborhoods like the Upper West Side, where kids, like, parents fight to get their kids into these public schools. So you can find some great ones, but it's just the it's just too much difference between the good ones and the bad ones and where they located. Because I grew up in Bed-Stuy, I went to PS-137 in Brooklyn. Our school was pretty good, and IS-271. We had good schools, but they weren't great. But we had like community given back to our school, so we had like fundraisers and things like that. But they bought computers and you know equipment for the band and stuff like that. So it had to be like a grassroots thing to supplement what we weren't getting from the city.
Well, there's some very good schools in the Bronx. I don't know if the science
Bronx High School of Science. That's still there. Well, before we have to break in just a minute, but let me ask you both on the issue of the specialized high schools. Now, the Bronx High School of Science, Stuyvesant, Brooklyn Tech, number of other specialized high schools are public high schools, among the best in the country. They're elite schools, and there have been some complaints from some black parents, some Hispanic parents, that almost the entire student body in these schools is Asian.
Yeah.
And there's been calls to do away with the specialized high school examination. And people that are graduates of these schools, including our owner, John Catsimatidis, they've pushed back and saying the solution is really not to do away with the test. What's your take on that?
Some people say the tests are biased. You know, I had friends that graduated from Brooklyn Tech and Stuyvesant. I went to Bishop Lachlan High School, so I went to a private school. But a lot of people say I took the test to get into these schools, and some I passed, and some I just wasn't comfortable with going to, like, because I have to get up so early and like 4 o'clock in the morning to get up to the Bronx. So
yeah,
I wouldn't do that.
Nothing like being up at 4 o'clock in the morning. Judge, any thoughts on the controversy over the specialized high school admissions?
No, I'm a person who believes in equality. The person that deserves to go to those schools should be the ones that get in.
Yeah. 800-848-WABC. Judge Herb Dodell is here. Sherrod Small is here. We'll continue with your
77 WABC. It's the Other Side of Midnight. Best of. 77 WABC. It's the Other Side of Midnight. Best of.
This is the Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Moreno, joined for the hour by Judge Herb Dodell. He is a retired California Superior Court judge, also the host of the radio show For the People, which airs out there in California, and the author of the book From the Trench to the Bench, Navigating the Legal System and Finding Your Spiritual Path Along the Way, available wherever books are sold. And Sherrod Small, a stand-up comic and the host of the podcast Race Wars. Sherrod, if people want to come see you, are you performing anywhere anytime soon?
Yes, I'll be at the Comedy Cellar all week at the Stand Comedy Club on East 16th Street. And plus, I'm producing shows, More World Comedy. We started producing shows every Thursday. It's on the 24th. 8 p.m. at the New City Winery.
So you pick the comics? Is that how that works?
Yeah, I book the comics. It's all hot comics in the city.
How have things been since the city reopened again and allowed comedy clubs to reopen?
It's been great. It's been packed. All the shows at the Comedy Cellar have been sold out since they started back up. And the Stand, they've been doing outdoor shows, indoor shows, upstairs and downstairs. The Comedy Cellar even changed one of the bars into another comedy room to, you know, the crowds in. So everybody's back. People are back and hungry for it.
And there's no mask mandate or anything.
There's no
like
mask
that.
Mandate. I think they might have, you might have to show your vaccination card or on your phone, but that's it.
And, Judge, are you performing anywhere that people can come see you do stand up legal commentary?
Yes.
Not yet, but who knows?
We're just going to do something at New York Law School. Remember, Judge?
Yes, we were going to do it. A subject for another day.
Yes.
We were gonna do a show together, basically a trial with a lawyer on both sides, and having the audience decide who wins or loses on various rulings, and I would explain the law.
Yes.
It didn't go because of the COVID thing.
Yeah, the pandemic got in the way of it, but I'm looking forward to doing that as well.
Yeah, that ruined a whole lot of fun plans for everybody. All right, before we get out of here, Judge, let me ask you about the issue of government leaks. Yesterday happened to be the anniversary of the Pentagon Papers. There's a lot of leaking controversies in that President Trump and his Department of Justice apparently were, according to some news outlets, a little too heavy-handed in how they were investigating leaks during his administration. Now, under the Biden administration, there's a whole investigation of how the news website or the news source ProPublica got all this tax information about the tax returns of the super wealthy. How far can the government go in terms of plugging these leaks?
Well, you have to first determine what the definition of a leak means. Certainly, the government has been, over the years, seeking to find out information about members of Congress or staff or whatever if it involved national security. certainly nobody could argue that that shouldn't be done. The problem is that we were bordering on basic authoritarianism. At this point, if you can investigate your enemies, your political enemies, that's not a good thing, because it becomes very selective and it becomes very targeted. And so I think at some point in time, either the Justice Department or the AG's office will do something about it, but I'm not so sure that they'll get anywhere, because as long as people are trying to beat the other guy, there's always going to be some kind of hanky-panky, and it's probably going to continue on. Although now with the public disclosure, maybe a little bit less, while it's still a hot subject for the public.
Yes, it seems weird how they got the records from Apple. How can you just go get records from Apple? Can an ex-girlfriend do that for me, Judge? I'm concerned.
Probably could.
Wow.
Yeah, they're the most resourceful researchers out there. All right, that's about all the time we have. Judge Dodell, I want to thank you. I hope we can do this again in the future. I'll certainly be on the lookout for whenever you and Sherrod are doing anything together. You guys always have a nice repartee with one another.
We do.
Yes, thank you.
Well, thanks very much for having us. It was a very enjoyable hour of time.
Well, yes. And whenever you're up for staying up late, you're always welcome. Sherrod, thank you as well. Best of luck with Race Wars. Now, you had Eric Adams on the Race Wars podcast.
Oh, yes, that's right. Yeah, he was great. Yeah, and he's running for mayor, so I'm pulling for him. Let's see.
Did you vote yet?
Early voting started Saturday. Yeah, I didn't start yet. I'm a vote up.
That's how upset you are about the ranked choice voting. You won't even vote.
It's like March Madness. I don't know how many teams to pick.
check him out. Sherrod Small. Performing and producing,
yes.
all over the city. His website is smallworldcomedy.com.
Yes.
You visit that website, a whole world opens up. Smallworldcomedy.com. Thank you very much as
Thank
well.
Thank you, Frank.
All right, coming up next hour, we'll take your calls on any subject. You know what we're going to do? We're going to do commendations. We usually do commendations in the 3 o'clock hour on Mondays, but because we have these two esteemed gentlemen here, we're going to do that next. And we'll tell you who deserves a pat on the back, and some of the answers may surprise you. And I'll tell you what I spent my weekend doing, if you care to hear about it. 800-848-WABC. We're on Facebook as well, facebook.com/MoranoFan. Want to encourage you, especially if you are not totally mean-spirited, to join our Facebook group. Just go on Facebook and type Morano Radio Fans and Haters, MORANO Radio Fans and Haters. This is a week where the haters were winning. I must tell you, the stuff that's been coming out of the Facebook group this week, I mean, I want to leave it. So you can check it out. And if you're nice, don't hesitate to answer the haters back. Until next hour, keep your knees loose and your glove well oiled.
77 WABC. It's the Other Side of Midnight, best of.